Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Then press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
We're rolling here. Sit down or something. The grasslands are a tremendously fertile place. But without the buffalo, it's a different place. Putting those animals back on the grasslands. And we were selling the meat to make ends meet, but there was no market for buffalo hides. So we said, well, let's see if we could make boots out of them. If you could make a boot out of it rather than throwing it in the trash like everybody else, that's progress.
we're off to a great start. It's a good vibes about this. Okay, so yeah, I'm Colton Jones. My wife's name is Jillian. We have two boys, Barrett and Lincoln, three dogs, Bruce, Malcolm, and Gretchen. I think we've got three cats, Ralph, Kevin, and Bandit, and an array of chickens and cows. And about 1,000 buffalo, yeah. We won't go through all their names. You'll run out of film.
My family and I live on the Cheyenne River Buffalo Ranch, and we raise 100% grass-fed, field-harvested buffalo.
There's endless seas of grass, and all those grasses and root systems have evolved to thrive off of those grazing habits of the bison and their movements, the way their hooves are beating the dirt down and breaking up the top crust of the soil. It's just a cycle that's went on for millennia. What we're trying to do by reintroducing the bison to the Great Plains is to put that missing piece back to something that's been broke for a really long time. You know, we see a change in biodiversity in the grass species. We see a change in biodiversity among bird species. All the wildlife and fauna has changed pretty dramatically over a 20-year period.
You know, we have to have healthy land, healthy soils, and then that feeds the buffalo, which then in turn feeds us.
All of them.
Bringing back the keystone species of buffalo, we really end up with a byproduct of 100% grass-fed buffalo meat.
Doing good. This will probably be our last run before calving starts.
We try to treat them as close to nature's intentions as possible, give them respect in life and dignity in death.
We've also teamed up with Patagonia. We supply their bison jerky. But not wasting any part of the animal is a big part of Wild Idea's philosophy. We started kicking around the idea of a boot for Patagonia. There was finally a batch that we had put together. We're like, man, we hope this is the batch. We hope this is the batch that comes back from Portugal in the form of a boot.
The easy way is not the best way. It's very emotional. It's more than a pair of boots or shoes. My father started to make shoes with 14 years old, made by hand. And nowadays, we love to try to do the best boots in the world. Our boots, it's much better than my English.
Sem dúvida, pronto, isto. Eu sonho com botas.
Gosto imenso deste produto porque vê-se na naturalidade da pele que aquilo não tem químicos, não tem plásticos, pronto, aquilo é muito natural.
This is a boot with a long, long life. So we can replace the soles 1, 2, 3 times. It's always a challenge to improve and to find the best solution. We like this, we like the big challenge. So we find the best materials, all recycled, because we can produce a very nice boot with a very good quality and respect the environment. We think that's the future. That's the big opportunity to start a new age.
I think it's just cool to see a good conservation practice come to fruition and then be able to walk out in that grass where that boot started.
Can you guys see the buffalo?
I see them too.
Other than the sun, that's where that boot started, is right there at that grass level.
Four of them.
Yeah.
We lost a few. We lost 96.
You know, we had kids for a reason. I want them to have the option to enjoy this world out here at its fullest. That's why we go to work every day. That's why we put our work boots on, is for those kids. I think we're on the right track, and if we're doing it just right, then that's leaving things better than the way you found them.
The loss of grasslands is a huge tragedy. But what we're doing here is going to help. It's going to help.
The heart hardest part is knowing that you got to put your nose to the grindstone every day and you might not see a result tomorrow or the next day. It pays off, but in the form of saving our planet, you know?
It kind of cranks me up. Symbolically, metaphorically, boots are the foundation. I mean, that's how we get around here. Just to put those boots back in contact with this grass out here is, for me, pretty powerful. Hang on a second, I'm tearing up here, Christ Almighty. I'm good, I got sleeves. That's what I wear sleeves for.
All right, everybody. Hello, hello. Happy Sunday. You are listening to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show. Thank you so much for finding me today. And shortly I will bring on Doll. She is going to be my sidekick for the show tonight. And we do have a great show lined up. Special guest Nick Hess. I definitely want to welcome him to the show. He is a 2022 GOP candidate for Oregon governor, and I got a chance to see him talk about maybe a month ago or so now at a local event here that hosted all of the GOP candidates for Oregon governor, and I didn't get a chance to meet him, though, unfortunately, but hopefully he will call in here shortly. And then also big news, as you're probably finding out, I am going independent. I am no longer a part of a network of radio shows, so I am independent with my own plan and my own thing going on here. So with that, I'm going to bring Doll on. Hello,
Thank
Doll.
Thank you, Lorianne.
How
you
Thank doing
you.
Today?
It's great to be here.
So glad that you're joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. I love working together with you. You know, we have a lot of fun together. We've got a great guest coming on, and it's a important time. It, you know, every election season is, you know, every election is important, whether it is, you know, your local hometown election, you know, you live in a small town. And those are just as important as a presidential election, but Oregon really has a lot hanging on the line right now, and there's states that are really in need of strong leadership, so I'm always optimistic. I'm always excited to hear new ideas for places like Oregon, and so, yeah, I'm looking forward to Nick today, and I'm always happy to be with you, of course.
Of course. Let's see, and I'm using the Direct Connect for the host line, and instead of my phone, and like my phone next to me, and I keep like checking my phone like by habit to see if I hit it or not, but I'm not. So the Direct Connect on the computer, like the mute button is tiny, and it's kind of like hard to tell if you're muted or not because it is tiny, but that's just a technical issue here, but I'm trying it out for, I haven't used the Direct Connect in a long time, so I'm hoping that I don't have any issues, because when I have tried it in the past, it's been known to be a bit flaky, so, but I'm trying it out. We'll see. This is a
Your audio sounds fine.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Hoping
yeah.
so.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I do see that Nick is holding and raising his hand, so I'm going to bring him on in just a second. So, again, he is 2022 candidate for Oregon governor. he is a successful business owner and CEO of a technology and telecommunications company in the Portland metro area. He is the loving husband and father of his son. He is passionate about getting Oregon back on the right track after far too long being under Kate Brown's dictatorial reign and general Democrat rule over Oregon.
Some of NCC's top priorities are public safety, Oregon's worsening homeless problem, education, restoring a positive image of Oregon, and seriously overdue cybersecurity and technology upgrade for Oregon's systems. And so with that, I am going to welcome NCC in.
Hey, Lori.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, NCC. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
Right on. Are you settled? Have you had a busy day today, or have you had like a relaxing Sunday and hopefully you're just going to kind of kick back and relax on the show today?
Unfortunately, my father-in-law actually passed away a few days ago, so it's kind of been a little hectic. I had to jump off the campaign trail, and this is kind of my first event getting back into things. So,
I am so sorry to hear that. I didn't know that. I didn't see anything about that. Just a
yeah,
couple days
I'm
ago.
I'm a private guy, so I don't usually post a lot of things, but I had to leave. I was supposed to be in Vail today and was going to be driving back while I was on the phone with you, but I ended up being home, so... At least it's nice. The one good thing is at least I get to be home. You know, you don't get to do that very much during campaign season.
Exactly right. You never know where you're going to be sometimes when these things come up. Well, I definitely extra appreciate you coming on the show. I mean, if you needed to cancel because of that, that would be certainly forgivable.
No, it's no problem.
All right. Dahl, do you want to say hi to NCC?
Hi, welcome on into the show. I'm really excited about your campaign. I had the opportunity to do my homework on you, and you're addressing some very critical issues.
Well, I hope you didn't find any skeletons in my closet while you're doing your homework.
No spring cleaning yet. We'll see how you do in the primary. No, I'm really kidding.
See, that's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for somebody to finally attack me, you know? It's just like, it's one of those things in politics that you're just like, okay, so when's it going to happen? What are they going to come up with? I'm dying to know.
All right. Yeah, so spoiler alert, not today.
Not today.
We're
not
friends.
Unless Joe calls
we're
in.
Friends.
A frequent caller Joe that really likes to, you know, really likes to drill candidates, political candidates. And so he usually refrains from calling in when I have guests on, particularly political candidates, for that reason. He's like, they'll never want to call into your show again if I get after them, you know, and it's like, doesn't matter who it is.
I love it.
And I'm like, okay, well, I guess, you know, if you're going to call in, I'll have to warn my guests, you know, like, put your armor on, you know. Oh, boy. Okay, so where should we begin? First, let's just hear a little bit of about you and what your motivation was for putting your hat into this race in Oregon for governor and why you decided to disrupt your whole life for a while.
And it is that, definitely a disruption. You know, for 21 years I've been CEO of my own companies. I have lived here all my life, and I just kind of started getting frustrated with the way that things have been going. There's just so many problems, and there's just no common sense in our government anymore, and there's really nobody listening. And that was really what started kind of this whole thing, was just that I didn't feel represented at all by anybody that's running for office, by anybody that's in office. And I'm the kind of guy that just likes to do and fix it if I can. And that's kind of where this whole thing started. There were other things along the route that kind of got me here, but, you know, the closures of things. In addition to my cybersecurity company, my wife and I also own a cooking class business that we opened the day that everything had to shut down, basically, Friday the 13th of 2020. And so that was really frustrating and really hard on us. And, you know, there was no support. Oh, my God. Yeah. It was just awful. The story is actually a little bit longer than that. We kind of had a feeling something was coming because we were actually on our honeymoon in Australia in January when everything was starting to get shut down there. We just were like in la la land. You know, we had already 6 months into our build out on this thing, we're like, well, it's never going to happen in the U.S. They're never going to close things down. And, you know, obviously.
No way.
I wish I had a time machine.
Yeah, I think we all thought that.
Yeah, I did not. I mean, I thought happening in other parts of the world, but, you know, this is America. I never thought that we would ever accept that or that it would ever happen. So, but during that process, I got more active in politics. I started writing Kate Brown letters and, you know, pointing out that there was no common sense to this. At one point, I had about 15 other restaurants together, and we were like, look, we could open with just give us 10% of our tables. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole thing. I understand public safety and all, but give us 10%. There's 40 feet between every person inside this place, you know, and I got no response. And again, that's just another example of, you know, politicians not representing the people and change of the job, I guess, from what it's supposed to be. So that and everything else, you know, just kind of led me towards the path of running. And I was fortunate enough to be at a point in my career where I was ready to take a sabbatical, a little time off from work. I mean, I'd been busting my butt for a long time, and I have a great team around me, so I wasn't really needed at work anymore. I kind of built myself out of a job. So I decided to, you know, do this other thing for another job instead of doing nothing, because that's also me. I'm kind of a workaholic, so it's hard for me not to do anything. That's kind of where it all started.
Very nice. And you know that you talk at the GOP event here in Salem, you know, and just through our communication.
By the way, that was
my
worst GOP event ever.
You heard me talk at the worst one. You were busy talking with people. And so, but yeah, why was that bad?
So I'm not a big religious person, and it was an overwhelmingly church session. We started out with a bunch of praising and song and everything, and I was incredibly uncomfortable, honestly.
Oh wow!
So it was probably my least well done event of all of them, just because of it. It threw me off my game a lot.
Oh wow!
So it's funny that you saw me at that one.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, you can't really be too surprised given that it was being held in a church. So,
yes, that's true. And there's other ones that are held in churches that don't go that route. It's just kind of, I know they had a mandate because of their lease and things like that where they were required to do that. I didn't know what to expect from that. So it was kind of a weird scenario that I ended up in.
Got it. Okay. And, you know, and I think that's probably one of the differences, too, is I think that, you know, a lot of GOP candidates tend to be very religious Christian people.
Yep.
And so I think that, you know, that can be either to your benefit that you're not a very religious person, or it could be a detriment, you know, one or the other, depending on your audience, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the GOP is forgetting about in Oregon. It's something that I've fought back against a lot, about approaching people with more open arms and not looking at, you know, a couple of small issues, religion and abortion, to name a couple, that are tend to end up being blown up into much larger issues, even though they go across political lines. You know, there's people who are religious on both sides. There's people who are pro-life, pro-choice on both sides. And yet we take those two issues and make them everything in the Republican Party, it seems like, in Oregon, and then alienate everybody who doesn't believe exactly down the party line. So it's a struggle, for sure.
Would you see yourself as more of an independent versus a GOP because of some of the differences of views that you have with the standard, you know, GOP party line?
And I've been asked that a lot. And the reality is, in general, what a Republican stands for, I believe in. And I think that those are extra things that are not necessarily part of the core Republican Party. They've just been added on over the years. So let's call I'm more of an old school Republican on what Republicans should be striving for, in my eyes, is to be above all of that and to be more inclusive of more people.
Right on. Yeah. And then, which might be to your benefit here in Oregon, because, you know, we've been under Democrat rule for so long that having a very far right GOP person might be like too much change at once for a lot of Oregonians to get used to. So maybe that's one of the advantages that you have is being able to hopefully draw in some of the frustrated Democrats that are out there, and they are out there. Believe it or not, yes, there are Democrats in Oregon that are not happy with the way Kate Brown is running.
Many. And I talk to them all the time. There are tons. I mean, boatloads. I mean, I live in Portland, so I talk to them. If I go out and I'm talking with people at a restaurant, you know, 60%, 70% of them are Democrats. And I get a lot of support from that side that are, they're very frustrated. They're over it.
Yeah, and I think our frustration level is, you know, has accumulated over the last couple of years, you know, with all the COVID lockdowns and restrictions and this tyranny that was bestowed upon us. And then on top of that, then we had all the rioting that was going on, which has completely destroyed downtown Portland. I mean, nobody wants to go there anymore, and I'm one of them. Businesses are leaving downtown Portland for that reason, and they don't really want to come back, and opening up shop elsewhere and things like that. And so, you know, what is something that you have planned to try to revitalize downtown Portland and make it more welcoming again instead of the basically cesspool that it is right now?
Yeah. I mean, I have so many ideas. So the problem, though, is that it really is largely a Portland problem, you know, and that's the struggle is that as governor, you don't really have end-all, be-all control over what Portland does because that's up to their leadership. That's up to Ted Wheeler and the city council. It is very interesting what Ted Wheeler has done where he has basically issued an emergency order and taken control of over all of the homeless problem. Which we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, at least there's somebody to blame if it fails because he's been blaming, you know, the city council and everything, and now it's just on his shoulders. So we'll see how that plays out. But I do think from the governor's level, there are things that we can do to put pressure on the city. You know, I advocate really heavily for making sure that we have are spending money on programs that have proven results. So a track record of showing success, of getting people clean and sober, off the streets and into long-term housing with jobs. Okay, so that's what I consider a success. There are programs out there that are doing really good work at that, like Rogue Retreat down in Medford. So I think those are the type of programs that we need to be encouraging these cities and counties to move money to those type of programs instead of trying to run their own thing and reinvent the wheel every day. And that's kind of what Portland's done. I mean, Portland spent, what, $450 million the last few years on their own city-ran programs that cost at least $18 million a year plus in just administrative costs, and there's nothing to show for it. You've said it. You walk around, it's just ridiculous. Nobody wants to be there. Nobody wants to be in that city. So there are good things out there, and we need to start moving the money. I think the governor can encourage that, can use, you know, budget, can do things with the budget to move money in that way, and then hold back some money from the city if they won't move their money going to the right place that we know works. When it comes to crime, I think that, you know, there's a lot of governor candidates that have been like, well, I'm going to arrest Mike Schmidt or I'm going to do blah, blah, blah. You know, that's not in the purview of the governor's office necessarily. But what I think is using that platform to say, hey, if you're not going to prosecute all violent crime, then I'm going to lobby against you. I'm going to start pushing for you to be recalled, and I'm going to start pushing for somebody to replace you that will prosecute all violent crime and will support our police and that type of thing. And I think that's the role of the governor, not necessarily to go and take control of it. It's still its own city. They're their own thing, but we can help push them in the right direction.
Good answer. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to just be another dictator only under the GOP flag.
No, that doesn't solve anything. Yeah, go one way or the other. And back to your point on, you know, a super far hardcore right person, that would be no different than a Kate Brown the other direction. And I guarantee if that did somehow get in, you ended up with 4 years, and then all the Democrats would be like, well, this was a failed thing. And then we would never get a chance at the office again because they would all be rallied against it and be like, well, we tried it. It didn't work. It was way worse than we had the other way in their eyes, at least. You know, it wasn't somebody that was trying to work together, bring the two parties together, pull those people in an all-inclusive way and listen to them. It would be the same thing where they'd be like, oh, well, you're a Democrat. I'm not going to listen to you. Just like Kate Brown is, oh, you're a Republican. I'm not going to listen to you. That doesn't help us.
Exactly. And, you know, with Kate Brown, it's, you know, there's a lot more to Oregon than just, you know, Portland and Salem. I mean, it's vastly Republican once you get out to eastern and southern Oregon. And I definitely feel that they are not represented as they should be and are ignored. You know, and yet at the same time, you know, they're not exactly powerless either. I mean, like back a couple of years ago when the GOP legislators led Oregon to not to make sure that the vote for the capping of CO2 and all that
cap and trade
happened. Yeah, the cap and trade policy, and you know, and that whole thing, it made me laugh in a way because I just thought it was so funny, like her, you know, sticking the sheriffs off to, you know, they're here, arrest them and bring them here, you know, and I'm just like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This is really happening.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
hopefully that wouldn't
there's very little
happen
power.
Again on the opposite.
That's probably exactly what happened if we had flipped it. But, you know, there's very little power. And, you know, something in that that's a perfect example of Republicans in Oregon have largely for a long time tried to fight every fight instead of picking and choosing their battles, you know, and picking and choosing what's truly important to them and making trades for, you know, seats on committees, you know, or chairs of committees. Chairs of committees is the ultimate power in the legislature, and yet we hold none. And that's because we've never actually tried to leverage our way into a seat. And so I think that that's a really important lesson that should be learned at some point in Oregon when you're a minority. You know, the U.S. Senate and U.S. House has often used this method and often done that where they have given up a little bit to take, you know, some power. And that's kind of how it's supposed to work when you're working in a bipartisan fashion. You can't win every battle. You can't lose every battle in that way, but maybe you can win a few more than what you're winning now.
Exactly. So what is your position on, like, okay, so Nick Hess wins the election, and you are now Oregon governor day one. What are your priorities to do, and in particular with your stance on the use of executive orders?
So my stance on the use of executive orders is none. I don't think that that's – I don't like temporary things. I want to make permanent changes that are good for all of us. So my goal would be to, you know, influence things and push, you know, an agenda that's good for Oregon forward, which is largely around our main problems of drugs and alcohol addiction, education problems, homelessness. You know, some technology things that really need to happen, wildfires, like those type of things. I think we can push things forward, and I think we can do that in a bipartisan way with a, just a little bit of a change of leadership and kind of encouraging that flow. I want to see us working bipartisan no matter what. That's what I've said all along. I don't want to dictate one way or the other. I want legislature to do their job, and I want them to bring me bipartisan bills. But I also want to see more larger issues go out to the public for vote. You know, one of those things we would have to do for vote would be a fix to Measure 110, for instance. I think generally everybody agrees it's flawed. It needs to have teeth added into it, although we need to have mental health facilities first before we could do that because we don't have any. But that's a Oregon Health Authority issue that I think I can change right away just by changing their mandate on certificate of need and mitigating that and getting rid of it altogether. But the very first step, going back to the original question there, is transparency. So every bit of data that I have access to, I will make public immediately. We'll do that through dashboards and through the Oregon website. And then I will try and work with Shamia Fagan to release more voter data as well in her best interest, since I would be winning this election on transparency and she'll be up for election in 2 years. It would be in her best interest to be a transparent person as well. So my goal would be to get as much data in front of the people, because that's how we can figure out where the problems are and where we can really solve things, especially when it comes to budgets.
Very good. What about using executive orders to undo Kate Brown's executive orders and things that are outstanding? Would you make an exception for that to sort of undo some of those executive orders and then start fresh?
I would review everything that she has as executive orders and decide what's good and what's bad. Of course, we would look at that. And, again, those were not passed through legislature, so I think that they should basically go. That's what they're there for. Typically what happens, everybody comes in and removes the last, which is why I don't like executive orders. But it is good to get a clean slate on a lot of those things that aren't good for Oregon.
Right on. Very good. I like that because, there's a reason why legislators take a while to introduce a bill and write a bill, introduce it, examine it, vote on it. There's a reason why these things take some time. Bills shouldn't be rushed through. Like we see with our federal government over and over and over again, they'll put thousands of pages of legislation, pop it in their lap and go, okay, we're going to vote on it in 24 hours, and just ran it through.
Who read that? Nobody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I got through 4 or 5 pages before we had to vote on it, and it's just that sort of ridiculousness, I think, is on the federal level should definitely not be repeated on the state level.
Absolutely agree. There is no reason for it. But another thing that bothers me about legislature is that legislature for a long time has been listening just to lobbyists and not necessarily to everyday people. And that needs to change too. Like, we really need to get more involvement with everyday citizens on these issues. And I think that comes back to kind of an education thing, like educating people on how they can get involved, how they can come testify on issues that might affect them. And then really encouraging that as like a good thing. Like, we want that feedback. We want them to be engaged. But I think it also comes from leadership, in that if the governor is seen out and about with people, everyday people, all the time, which is my goal. My goal as governor will be to be engaged in every community as often as possible. I visit 2 or 3 different counties a week, and be out engaging with people as often as I possibly can. And not just elected leaders, I'm talking like at a coffee shop being like, hey, come out and meet me, let's chat. I want to know what I can do to help you, what's going on in your life. I want to understand their story. And I would believe that if the governor is doing that, that would encourage the legislature to also be more engaged, because they would see that as kind of the way that they're guided from their leadership. And I think the constituents would start to expect it too. So for them to end up getting reelected, they would have to start engaging with everyday people.
I like it. Because, way too often people get out of touch. And they just don't listen to what real life and for an average person or people that are struggling, what they're really experiencing and what the challenges are. So, you brought up education. And so that should be another good question is, what is your plan for improving the dismal situation we have with our education? Oregon is, I forget how low we are, but it's pretty dismal.
48 out of 50.
Graduation rates and what they're learning, and then Kate Brown going, we're going to, math and reading comprehension is racist. So we're going to remove that as a graduation requirement from high school because it's racist. And that just floored me. I'm like, what?
I think it floored most of the state.
Like that. What?
I think it floored most of the state. I don't think it was just you. I think it was everybody that felt kind of slighted by that.
Wait a minute. Yeah, you know, like what kind of insanity did she wake up with that morning? I mean, and so what is your plan? How is your, what difference do you want to make in regard to improving our education and making sure that the students that graduate are, you know, productive, knowledgeable, you know, they know the basics and beyond, you know, and encouraging extracurricular activities, getting money back into programs that have probably been cut that benefit students, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think it's really difficult because the way that our education system is set up is that not everything comes from the state capital. You know, there's a lot of independent mindedness that goes into each individual school from their local school boards. But, you know, legislature did set that mandate, which lowered the educational requirements to basically nothing. So that needs to go. But that, again, that the legislature change is going to have to change to make that happen, which is kind of frustrating. But, you know, we do need high standards. We need our kids ready to go on to college, and we need our kids ready to live a life and be productive members of society. And saying, hey, you don't have to learn anything and you could still graduate, it's really not encouraging anybody to be a good member of society. Or I'm not sure how any college would ever accept an Oregon graduate over any other state that actually has standards, you know. If you're looking at them side by side, how do you pick an Oregon kid over another? I mean, I think you're just holding them back even more by doing that. But I do think we can, you know, short of, I would like ultimately, my ultimate goal is to see like a school choice type of thing pass to where we can create competition in our schools, create more of a free market to where they have to actually perform very well. Because short of that, it takes a lot of local involvement, a lot of parents to get involved to make changes at every local school level because we just have independent schools in Oregon. You know, there's a little bit of guidance on what curriculum they have to teach, but it's not overall, like they're still picking what textbooks they teach at the local schools and things like that. That's not central control in Oregon. They also have independent teacher contracts at every school and things like that. So it's very complicated issue in the state of Oregon with it all being split. But there are things that I think we could do from the state level by issuing guidance on what we would like to see, where we would like to see that it's okay for parents to be involved in their kids' classrooms, that we would like to see transparency at the local schools and having the parents be asked, you know, what's okay for their kids to learn or not learn. I think that those are types of things that we could issue as encouraging guidance from the state level and hope that they adapt to that at the local levels. And then also just really educating parents on how they can get involved. And again, you know, using the platform of the governor's office to encourage and train, teach parents on what they could do to help with their kids' schools.
I was going to give a moment for Sal to speak up if she wanted to.
Oh, hey. Oh, well, you know, yeah, the school board stuff, that's the local level and all of that. What I'm curious about is we're going to segue out of that then since I got the mic. And let's discuss, all right, now there's everybody wants a greener earth. They want a greater earth. You know, they want this and that. But sadly, the path to that is a long path, and it's going to take natural resources to get there, whether we like it or not. As governor, what is your interest or what is your plan to get people, Oregonians, back to work? I'm talking about renewable forestry projects, you know, getting in there and cleaning up stuff so that there's not fire, you know, the fire seasons anymore, and going back to maybe challenging the Biden administration on the roadless rule.
So I think I'm absolutely for, you know, responsibly cutting timber. I think it's a great product that we have in Oregon. It's something that we should be, you know, natural resource that we have, we should be utilizing. You know, the reality
Most
is
definitely.
That when we look at green and, you know, being more sustainable, you know, trees produce the most oxygen when they're young. You know, and that's removing carbon from the atmosphere and putting out oxygen. You know, that's a good thing. So in reality, if we want to help our environment, our atmosphere and whatnot, we'd be doing it a favor by actually harvesting our trees responsibly. You know, and it sucks that there's, a few bad eras in history that gave that a bad name, honestly. You know, there, when you had the clear cutting of just massive amounts of trees and just overcutting, it gave it a bad rep, even though it's really a good thing for the environment. So we really have to kind of get those two sides together and have that conversation. And I think it comes back to something I talk about a lot, not listening to lobbyists. You know, lobbyists can get really, really loud, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're right. It just means that they're really, really loud. And so I think that listening to people who are involved in that day to day, listening to even scientists that deal with that, that understand how that is producing more oxygen, how it's good for the environment, versus listening to everyday lobbyists that just have skin in the game and want something one way or the other because they're going to profit from it. You know, that's not really good for us as Oregon. So I think everything that we should be doing in our efforts to be sustainable and green needs to be, you know, tempered. We can't do everything overnight. We can't be in it alone. We need to be leveraging technology. We need to be looking at ways that we can do something and have a long-term plan that's good for the environment, but not killing businesses tomorrow. And that was the big problem with cap and trade. Cap and trade was all about making businesses bigger because only big businesses would survive. It killed every single small business by doing that type of thing, or it will, because you're basically making the only businesses that can afford it are the big conglomerates. So they would come in and buy up all the little guys, and you have a lot more big conglomerates, which is kind of ironic for the Democrats who seem to be anti-big conglomerates. So I don't really understand that mentality, but you know, cause and effect, when you make that action, the effect is that's what happens. So it's, you know, we have to be tempered with it. We have to have a plan, a long-term plan, and I think we need to encourage certain technologies to come further because there's a lot we can do with technology. It just needs to become more cost-effective.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's troublesome to see, you know, like you say, the technology is there and it's forthcoming and there's new stuff coming out every day. But yet there's the decades and centuries of history and science that we already know about the environment there. And like you said, it's not fighting common sense or science. It's fighting the lobbyists. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it'll be.
They're very loud.
Yes, they are. Yeah, you would be very good for Oregon. Oregon needs somebody that's not afraid, you know, to buck back a bit.
And I've said, the louder you are, the less I should listen.
So you're not going to be taking like big donations from these lobbyists so that they can get their way then?
No, I will not. If somebody asks me for anything, they can keep their money. I'll just use my own. It's fine. You know, and I haven't taken any big money. I've been very vocal. I know that you follow me on social media, so you've seen all of my stuff, but I've been very vocal against those that are taking big money. I think that's a huge problem in Oregon. It's ridiculous that we have no campaign finance laws. It's crazy to think that a governor campaign could spend $20 million on these things, or 48 or something like that between the two sides. I mean, that's just crazy. We have only 4.5 million people in this state. It's just an astronomical amount of money to reach voters. We desperately need campaign finance reform to prevent that.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it's just how much, you know, like instead of millions of dollars going into these campaigns, that money could be like donate it to some really good charities, especially local charities. You know,
yeah.
I'm not talking the
and then they could have a tax
you know
break
the,
for it too.
The corrupt big huge monsters that everybody knows. I mean, so many of these large charities that everybody's familiar with tend to be so corrupt, and so little money goes to actually purpose of the organization. And it's the small grassroots people that, you know, spend just about every dollar they can on actually helping people, that I think could use the boost up. You know, instead of donating a big bunch of money to my campaign, donate it to this and this and this local organization that supports X, Y, and Z issues, like human trafficking, for example. One of the ads that I play is One's Purpose, and they're one of the few organizations here in Oregon that are helping to combat human trafficking and actually helping the victims of it with just about anything, with clothing, with trying to find them shelter, with the mental health aspects and therapy, even equine therapy, whatever it is to
okay.
assist.
What charity was
people.
That?
One's Purpose. Okay. Yeah, I play their ad on the beginning of my show and during the breaks, and so they're boots on the ground. They're the stories of the people that they help. It's really eye opening, and it's baffling to me how human trafficking is such a problem here in Oregon, because it's, we got all up and down the I-5 corridor here, so it's a, for the West Coast, it's definitely a hub for human trafficking and sex trafficking. And yet it
yep.
just seems like there's so little resources going into it to help combat it and get these victims out of that lifestyle and out of that brainwashing that they go through and getting them on their own 2 feet again. And that's
mm-hmm.
a pretty important thing. So what are some ideas that you have to combat human trafficking and provide all the needed services that these victims have?
I mean, again, I think it comes back to funding the right nonprofits that know how to do this. I do think that there's making sure that the state patrol is well-funded for that department, which I know that's one of the things that's been a struggle for them off and on, is not having the funding because they don't. One of the things that has happened in all of our police is that the parts where they do more community outreach have been lacking because of the shortage of staffing. And I know that state police has also ran into that in a lot of ways. And I imagine part of that is their outreach programs, which include training and things like that for, motel staff and hotel staff. That those are important pieces of the puzzle to, engaging with people who are being trafficked and understanding that what's happening so that they can get police involved and ultimately take them out of that situation so that they can get help. But then you need the nonprofits that are there to help them. So we have to make sure that there's funding on all sides to take care of that. And I think that there is more and more, it seems, in hearing what legislature is moving on that they are more and more thinking about funding that. But it is amazing how long it has taken, because I agree with you, it's a very big problem. And you talk to any sheriff in Oregon, again, actually talking to the people who are dealing with this on the ground, and they'll tell you that it's a big issue that they deal with all the time. But yet, it hasn't been something that legislature has seen as a big issue to actually fund at proper levels, at least. They always have a little bit of funding for it, but it's never at the right level. So I think we just need a change in leadership and somebody who's more willing to engage with those groups and understand what their needs are so that we can make sure that they get those needs fulfilled.
Right on. And encouraging, like I said, I think, it's not so much as using, let's make a new tax. Let's tax even more so we can fund this.
We have plenty of money in Oregon.
Yeah, which I like, which segues into, you've talked a lot about audit and transparency. And so and you've said something, in your short videos and stuff, but I wanted you to speak to that as well, a little bit more in depth here on the show.
So, I think that until we can have transparent data, we don't know where we can, cut inside of the government. But the ultimate goal should be to minimize our government using the existing resources that we have. And, it's not easy because in, government world, and coming from the private sector, it's easy for me because I can say, okay, well, I'm just going to lay off 20 people and it's no big deal. And in the government side, we have to attrition out people and or, you know, plan for the replacement of people because they're poorly performing, which can take a year because of unions and things. But, you know, I think there is a way of doing it, but we need to have all of that data first. And that's where I talk about transparency, because right now when you go and look for budget data and things like that, you get the general overview from the State of Oregon website. You get the high-level numbers and things like that, but you can't dig into each department and down to each group inside that department and see what's costing all that money. Where is it all going, you know? Where's all the tax dollars going from our gas tax? Where's everything going from every little bit of money that we give the government? And that's what we need to be able to see. And I don't think that we need to have, you know, audits from the government side. I think once we make the data public, the public will take care of that for us. There are plenty of smart people out there that are dying to get their hands on this information and audit stuff for us. So I think if we can make some more data public, we'll start hearing from people, you know, questioning different things and kind of pulling back that veil. And that's not going to cost the government anything. You know, doing a government audit costs a fortune. Dennis Richardson proved that with the election audits that he did back when he was in office. And he did a couple of those, and it was like $18 million. So getting the public on our side to do our dirty work would really help. And, you know, they have a vested interest. They're paying taxes. They want to know where their taxes are going.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I have so many questions. Like, you know, we have our 10-cent bottled deposit, for example, and not everybody returns them, especially tourists. You know, it amazes me, like, when I go to hotels and there's no separate, like, bin in the hotel room for recycling your pop cans, you know, or bottles or whatever. And it's like, it's all collected in with the garbage, you know, things like that. You know, tourists often don't, you know, go and return them. And so there's this whole pool of money of these 10-cent deposits that, where does that money go? Who's getting it? How much money is that?
Yep,
not
your guess
being,
is as good as mine.
Yeah, like, that's what I want to know. You know, it's things like that that just make you scratch your head going, okay, what, you know, where's this money going? How much is it? And then going into something that I think I brought up I brought it up in past shows or whatever, but how Oregon, given that you're in the tech industry, Oregon was given $80 million back in, what, 2000? Or no, 2010 or something? Yeah, so it was like 2010, the federal government gave us a grant for $80 million to upgrade just the Oregon Employment Department systems because they're so super outdated. And the best I read, last year they finally just started, they were they start upgrading the systems. And I haven't heard anything about it since. And so what happened with this $80 million that's just been sitting there? And then now they say, well, now it's going to cost $125 to upgrade all our systems. Well, if
yeah,
they had done it
cheaper
back
over
when
time.
They got the money, it wouldn't have cost that much. And then number two, what happened to all that interest? Like, is that $80 million just sitting in an account somewhere and then all the dividends from that money accruing interest or whatever? What is that money going for? Because we shouldn't have just $80 million sitting there. We've had $80 million sitting there for 10 years. So where are those dividends and where's that money going?
It was a grant from the federal government. I know that part. So I assume any interest in things goes back to the federal government, for one. For two, though, we don't know because they would never release that information because it would look bad on the people who are in charge. And this is a problem. Why would you ever release information that's going to make you look bad and maybe make you so you don't get reelected or the other people in your party don't get elected? You wouldn't. They're protecting themselves no matter what. They're always going to protect themselves. So you have to have a change, and you have to have a change from somebody that has no skin in the game, doesn't care how long they stay there, just really wants to help their home, you know, and that's the only way you're going to get those changes. It's kind of like term limits. Nobody who's in office right now would ever vote their own term limit in, you know, but they should because it would be good for all of us. But, you know, again, there's self-preservation in that.
Well, I mean, you know, this, Yeah, they wanted to try to cover themselves because I don't think that a lot of people were really aware that Oregon even was granted $80 million 10 years ago or 12 years ago, and that money was has just been, you know, sitting there and waiting. And it blew up right in their face. That procrastination blew up in their face and made them look really, really bad when they implemented all of these COVID restrictions and lockdowns and yep. mandates and all this stuff. And so, therefore, all of a sudden, that old antiquated system became a huge issue because there were thousands and thousands of Oregonians that were waiting months and months before they could even see a penny of it because there was just such a huge flood of it. And the systems just couldn't keep up, you know. It just couldn't. And so that just backfires right in their face right there. And so why should anybody vote, or especially vote to reelect any legislator, anybody that was involved in that huge monumental, very painful for a lot of Oregonians, procrastination of not upgrading that system when, so it wasn't ready and it wasn't available and it was broken when we needed it the most.
So the problem is that the vast majority of voters have short-term memories. So by the time that they come around to vote, they've already forgotten about that, even though it was hugely impactful to our state. You know, and that wasn't the first time that we've had problems with technology and the money not being there. You know, that's the Oregon healthcare site. We had, there's a new DA program that I guess the DAs absolutely despise, and it was built by the same groups that's doing all this stuff. So even if they had redone the Oregon, you know, employment systems, I'm not confident that they would have even worked any better. They probably would have just had the same problems because they weren't built for it. You know, and that's the keys to the game is having people who understand technology that run it versus, you know, politicians.
Yes, that would be a definite benefit if you were to win, because you understand technology. You know, you understand what's involved with huge migrations over. And you know, I expect that it would probably cost even more than the estimated $125K now to upgrade the employment department, because
it wouldn't with me as governor.
Yeah, I mean, if they would have done it, it would have been a lot easier to migrate. But it's like, you know, it's not very easy to migrate from Windows 95 to Windows 2010. You know what I mean? Like, they're just not, you know, it's not backwards compatible that way. You know, it's, there's databases have changed. So much have changed that the migration of data into a new system is now going to be even more of a challenge because there's just so, you know, since so amount of time has passed, when these systems are so
old. Well, and I'm sure there are short-term fixes that they made. I'm sure their short-term fixes that they made during COVID will also be incredibly impactful on the cost. Because what they had to do to make this work very quickly was probably augment the database in a heavy way. So any changes that they're going to make in the future will actually be more costly because of those of the COVID changes they had to do to make that work.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling, and it's just, where is all this money going to come from? You know, and I think it's like a major overhaul needs to be made to find where all the waste is and find all the fraud. You know, the trillions of dollars in COVID relief that transpired was just a big, huge, like endless money pit for fraud. And, you know, I suspect that the fraud that has been discovered and unraveled so far probably constitutes maybe 5% of the fraud. Just maybe that we know of, you know, I'm guessing high there. You know, I just think that there's just so much more fraud that went on. It was just an open book to be taken advantage of, you know, and just reeling some of that in. And I think, you know, just focusing on finding the fraud and finding the waste will provide funding for just about anything that we could ask for, and, you know, education, environment, you name it, you know, human trafficking, all of that, if you just eliminate the waste.
I absolutely agree. I think we have a lot of waste. I mean, there are so many. I know I have a friend that works at ODOT, for instance, and they have, like, a whole extra person per team that's just there to double-check the team. Like, they don't even actually work every day. They just kind of sit around and wait for somebody to have something they need to have double-checked. And I'm like, well, you couldn't do that with, like, one person for the whole office? Not one person
that's
per team?
That's insane.
You know, it's like, wow.
Insane.
So stuff like that has got to go. That would be the type of stuff that I'd be looking at each department. Like, what are you doing?
Well, after this whole COVID scenario, the lockdowns, the, you name it, you know, the unemployment and the need for reliable technology that constituents can depend on to interact with their local leaders and their government. And I think that's really important in moving on from this. But that's a takeaway that not only Oregon, but many other states found themselves technically unprepared.
Yeah. Well, you know what, I would add to that I think what we're starting to get is also this point where we can now start to say the government should start looking at the people that are paying it as customers. And we should have good customer service from our customer departments, like the Oregon Unemployment Department. You know, their phone lines should have always worked. They should be working for us because we're paying them. And so if we need to call them, they should be available, and they should be top, very good, nice people willing to help us and go above and beyond to help us, because that's good customer service. That's totally lost in our government. You know, it's the same thing like the DMV not being open on Saturdays. You know, like, that's not good customer service. That's when a lot of people need to go to the DMV. You know, and the government needs to change the way that it's looking at things and start looking at the people that it's working for in that way, and treat them like they're customers, because they are paying them. The tax dollars pay for every part of our government.
Yes, they are. You know, and people can choose where they want to live, and you want to be able to have a state that is inviting and wants to repopulate and wants to grow economically and having good relations. Somebody like Kate Brown as a business owner, I don't see that as an inviting place to go start a business or a company.
No, it's not. We have terrible high taxes, terrible burdens on everything that we do. And, I mean, why would you want to come here? There's nothing encouraging. Everybody wants to leave.
Exactly. Well, it's good.
I know, and I don't want to be forced to leave. You know, I don't want to leave Oregon. There's so much to love about Oregon. But I don't want to be forced to leave because the state just, you know, this has gone downhill so much that, you know, there's no good jobs or, you know, jobs are leaving, good companies are leaving. It's impossible if I wanted to start a business. You know, it's an uphill battle all the way. And, being more inviting and more open to make those things easier would help. And then bringing our tourism back too, you know, as well. These businesses, I'm surprised even survived. I mean, the last couple of years, because especially along the coast, you know, all these businesses, resorts, hotels, all of the restaurants and coffee shops and everything that depend on the tourism to survive really took a huge hit the last couple of years, and they're trying to, you know, struggle to get that back up and running again. I remember when, you know, the lockdowns and restrictions and everything were happening, and it was like right at spring break, and I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be horrible for them. Because spring break is like, you know, the real first opportunity where there's a lot of tourism going on during spring break, and that was just completely gutted. So I'm just, like, I'm even curious to find out, like, how many businesses actually survived these last couple of years that were so reliant on tourism dollars.
Yeah. I think there are probably a lot of them that are hurting from that. I mean, it's especially around downtown Portland, obviously. You know, it would be nice if Travel Oregon, for instance, wasn't ran by salespeople. You know, you would think that at least our marketing agency for the state could be ran by marketing people. I think that would help right there. But, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen the Travel Oregon ads of late, but they're a little lacking. They don't really entice anybody to want to come here any more than Oregon actually does. But I think we just, until we clean up our messes, you're never going to turn people on to coming here again. There's too much bad publicity. For a long time, we were in the national news consistently, and it was all negative. So to rebuild from that, it takes a lot more positivity on the other side, and we have to get that make Oregon, you know, weird again vibe back that we had, that we used to have, that made people want to come here. And we don't have that at all. There's no swagger in the state. So it's really we have to clean up the messes before anything like that's going to change.
Exactly. And then same thing goes like with being attractive for like movie makers and TV production, TV show production. For a while there were several really big top-notch shows that were here and based out here in Oregon. And I haven't seen a whole lot of that lately. I don't think they really want to bring their camera crews anywhere near downtown for sure.
I also think the tax breaks for that expired, by the way. I think that's another big reason. I think we had like a 3-year program, if I remember correctly, that had really good tax breaks for the film industry. And then I think that expired back in like 2020 or 2021. Which is another, if you're not incentivizing anybody to come, they're not going to come. They're going to go somewhere else that's incentivizing them, like Georgia. It seems like everything's filmed in Georgia these days because they give a lot of money for filming. You know, so you have to incentivize businesses to open here and to come here and to, you know, film the film here. You know, there has to be programs for that. People don't just go somewhere for free because that's out of the goodness of their heart or whatever. I mean, they have to be incentivized, and it has to be shown to them that this is the right place to bring your business. This is the right place to do work. Because we have, you know, either lower taxes, or we have the right people, or we have the right technology or resources that they need. But that's, if we don't have any of those, then nobody's ever going to come here.
Exactly right. You know, and I miss being able to go up to Portland and actually enjoy it, because there are really some great stuff there in Portland to enjoy. You got the Rose Garden, you got the Japanese Garden, you got the riverfront, and you have, you know, like the Portland that ship, Portland Spirit. Yeah, you know, and like the jet boat rides and all that kind of fun stuff. I mean, Portland does have a lot of really fun things to offer, but they're just, you know, buried under all of this, you know, crime and gore and violence that's going on, and that's the real unfortunate part. I'd really like to be able to go back up to Portland and then actually enjoy it again.
Yeah, I agree. I would too. But, I mean, you know, we have to clean up the streets before anybody's going to feel comfortable with that. And it's still a long ways away, unfortunately.
Very true. Very true. And it's and then the challenge, of course, is to try to lower taxes, because we are, you know, taxed so high. Lower taxes while also having the funding that we need for the priority projects and the priority stuff that needs to be done, and then determining what those priorities are as well.
I mean, to be fair, we've had, what, $2 billion kicker checks every 2 years for the last 10 years at least. So there's plenty of extra money in our budget that we could give back as tax breaks. We also, once we start cutting things and find all the ways, there's probably plenty of money to just run every program that we possibly need, well-fund schools, everything, and still get some tax breaks back. I mean, our taxes are just crazy high, and we're not getting anything for it. We just need to actually, you know, use our money responsibly.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that housing, you know, housing is the other problem, you know, being priced out. Like, I don't even know, like, how do you even create a dent in what's going on? Like, for example, my own house that I bought, I got it about 6.5 years ago. I bought it for $200K, and its estimate is $420-something K now. So doubled. Absolutely no way I would be able to afford if I was buying it in the market. Absolutely no. Mm-hmm. There's no way I could afford to pay as much mortgage.
You're breaking up.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you're breaking up.
Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Direct Connect. Is that any better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Don't know why that was, but yeah, just talk.
So you're absolutely right, though. I kind of got the gist of what you were saying. You're absolutely right. Housing prices are crazy. You know, there's a many, many reasons for that. And really the only solution that I can say is that we really need to free the market. The more that we can let people build more easily and more densely in certain areas where it's more acceptable, like in retail urban areas and things like that, we could go up a lot more in those areas and create more inventory. Because right now we have the biggest problem is just a crazy inventory shortage. I mean, houses sit less than a week on the market. That's unheard of at any point in my lifetime and for most of history. So it's, when you have such little inventory, prices are going to skyrocket. You also have this influx of people because, ironically, we're less bad than California, which is kind of weird because it seems pretty bad here, but California must be really bad. So you have Californians, you know, moving here in droves and being able to pay cash, and that raises the rates up and things like that. You also have a decent-sized rental market, although as much as people complain about it, it's not as big of an issue in Oregon as it is in some other places because we don't really have the tourism travel that brings in on the tourism rentals, which are really what boosts the market high. So the best approach that I can see is to really free that market and really get more development happening more rapidly, you know, and encouraging, you know, new developers to come in and getting, you know, maybe some tax rebates or doing some incentives on utilities and things like that to help encourage new developments. But we just need more inventory, a lot more. I mean, tons of houses. I can't even remember what the number is, but it's tens of thousands of houses that we're short every year right now going forward. And we're not making a dent in it. Until we do that, we're not going to see the prices actually level out or even go down.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a great thing if I wanted to sell my house and move out of state and, you know, go to a state where it's a lot lower. I would, you know, rake in that all that extra equity and pocket it, right? But,
which is what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, exactly. But, I really don't want to do that because, like I said, there's a lot to love about Oregon. It just needs these problems.
Unfortunately, it's all the conservatives
and
that are selling high and leaving.
Yeah, there you go. I know. Yeah. And we don't want more we need more good conservatives here, you know, otherwise there'll just be no other voices. And, you know, I'm conservative libertarian. I have issues with the two-party system and stuff. And I think that somebody that isn't just following the party line all the time and cowering to the party line is a benefit because not everything that the GOP wants or promotes is necessarily a good thing. And same
mm-hmm.
thing with the Democrats. And so, of course, that's why I'm libertarian because, you know, I can hate both of them equally. No, I'm kidding. I don't hate. just disagree. but, yeah, there's so much. And then, you know, but I like the technical aspect because you are familiar with the tech industry, that makes you, I think, a very attractive person for this job, because if you don't understand technology and you don't understand how it can help or hurt, then you're not going to be very effective with what needs to be done, because it is 2022. We live in a technical society now, and if you don't understand those aspects, then you're not going to be an effective leader in utilizing the technology for good and utilize technology to help us.
And it can help in a lot of ways. I mean, technology does so much for our everyday life already. There's so much more that we can use that to leverage it to be good for all Oregonians. And I think when we talk technology, I think a lot of people end up jumping to like automation and things and like costing people jobs. And I'm not talking about that, but there are things that, you know, ultimately, you know, we talk about droughts and things like that. Well, there's technology out there that can help with that. You know, we could have desalinization plants and things like that. There's technology that gives us power, and, you know, even dams are technology. Like everything, every piece of this is all technology that we live in this world, and we can do even more with that. And I think it's good to have that person that understands that. But I think the other side to that that we haven't really touched on is the fact that our next crises in the future are coming from technology. You know, when we look at data breaches and things like that, those all come from the technology side of things. And that's a really big concern for a lot of people, and losing their data and things like that and how that's being protected. And that's something that our government needs to understand and do a better job at. Even our federal government, I don't feel like does a good enough job of securing our information. And it's something that's been a hot topic of controversy, but, you know, we need to have people in offices all over, not just the governor of Oregon, but all over, that understand technology and where it's going in the future, so that we are adequately protecting people's data.
I agree. And that is a form, also a big deal with our national security, our military, our national, you know, security, our financial institutions, our personal private data, you know, and the ability to keep that private, you know, that's important. And I do see that as a role in state government, especially when it comes to the government, state government's own coffers, you know, whereas it's say unemployment that, you know, and whatnot, knowing that your information is secure with them. Constituents have that right, and the state has an obligation to perform that duty.
Yep. Well, you mentioned unemployment. Think about Washington. During the whole pandemic, Washington lost all of their unemployment data. You know, that was a hack that happened, and they lost all of that data. It really swept under the rug very quickly, but they did. Every single person, they lost their Social Security numbers and everything that the Washington Unemployment Department had. You know, it's
and
amazing,
you know,
how stuff like that just gets lost. But
yeah, and Jay Inslee did nothing. He sat there. Well, he's a tool anyways, but he did nothing. And, you know, that woman was never censured. The audit has never been completed. And I do believe she is serving as some type of appointment with the Biden administration right now. She, the administrator of the Washington State Unemployment Office, was one of the biggest DNC money generators. She was the donor queen, and she raised more funds for Washington Democratic Committee than anybody else, and hosted several parties at her lakeside mansion unmasked while everybody else was locked in their homes. Boom. No, I just had to let that out. Oh, that woman. I hate to see that egregious abuse of power and the disregard that people have paid into those funds, and the government has a obligation to manage that money. They've been entrusted to manage that money, that state government. I mean, you know, it's refreshing to hear somebody like you, it's a business person. And I enjoyed watching some of your videos and stuff while doing my homework. And I loved how you said, I'm probably going to say the wrong thing sometimes. So I'm going to mess this up myself. You know, that's not what you said, but I'm saying that. But, you know, where you said, I might not use the biggest words. I might mess things up. And that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's a human thing. And I've had plenty of opportunities to, you know, vote for people and stuff. And the humanity level and the ability to say, hey, I might mess up, but I'm going to try my darndest to get right. I find that more believable than, hey, don't worry, the money's in the bag, we got this, you know, type thing. I'm like, no, you don't have this. You don't have this. So,
I despise people promising the world. So I think that's really important to just be an everyday person.
Yeah, and I think that's a very, very, I really admire that with you. And, you know, being a business person, it's been, you know, you've obviously trained your folks well in the business, and they're able to conduct business. You worked yourself out of a job, and I've been there before too. And I like how you're deciding to spend your time. You're young, you have a family, you have a vested interest. And when people have good constituents, make good leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So people that understand paying your dues, doing your tax, you know, paying your tax, doing all that is part of the process. But the rewards need to be there too. It's not just enough to be a law-abiding citizen. The state has to be a welcoming place. Otherwise, your job is to say, hey, Oregon's ready for business. Oregon's ready to build new homes. Oregon's ready to welcome you. You know, I've seen Kate Brown just lock everybody out. You don't like it, leave type attitude. And it's sad.
Well, it's her way or the highway. I mean, that's exactly what she did.
Exactly. Yes, with people, and you know, as a taxpaying constituent, not of Oregon, but, you know, and nonetheless, I can live anywhere I want in the United States, and I most certainly wouldn't want to invest in a state or community that didn't reflect some of my family values and see my tax dollars at work. And if they're not serving that and it's not happening, then I'd pick my family up and move.
Yep.
And a lot of people,
which is what we're seeing, a lot of people do. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's important to understand. Yeah. We're open for business and we're welcoming you. And that's what brings the businesses. That's what revives those coastal cities, regardless of tourism or not. You know, it's those little things.
Well, I think another role of the governor in that same realm is to be out and supporting those businesses, like showing what's cool about Oregon. Like, you have this massive platform, right? So use it. You know, show that cool bowling alley that is downtown Portland, or show that, show the beach. You know, go out to the beach and show the beach and how cool it is and all the cool rocks that you can see and whatnot. Like, use the platform to show how cool Oregon is. Like, that's another big role that the governor should be doing. Like that's your job is to sell people on this state. You're the leader of it. Get them to come here. Get your tax base to grow.
All she's acquired are cities all she's managed to acquire in her term is, you know, cities that have been burnt and raped and pillaged and, you know, communities and drug problems and, you know, you name it. And it's happening. And it's sad because, you know, places like Portland and Seattle used to be the gems of the West Coast. You know, if you didn't do one without the other when I was in my 20s, partying, it was always three nights in Portland, three nights in Seattle, and then one day in So, I mean, that was back in the day. I remember one time, I don't know where I'm at, but man, this place has got a lot of bridges. That's all I remember of that trip. But yeah, and I have so many fond memories of going to Portland and you know, book shopping and making a whole weekend out of it with my mom. And we'd go to the bookstore there in Portland and spend like literally 2 days just going back. Now I don't even want to leave my car in the parking lot.
Yeah,
hey, you might lose your catalytic converter.
Yeah, exactly. Lori Ann, can
luckily,
I get a ride to the bookstore? No.
I could give you a ride because I have a Tesla, so I love a catalytic converter. But
Nice.
Thankfully, it's a dangerous thing to have these days.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm in Southeast Alaska, so they can take it from the rental car when I come down on the rental car.
Just make sure to get that extra insurance so that it doesn't fall under yours and your rates go up. Right?
Exactly.
And really, the most dangerous place is the airport long-term parking. So, you know, as long as you don't go there, you're okay.
Good grief. That's just bad. That's yes,
I never thought
yeah.
in a million years I would actually advocate for getting the extra insurance when you rent the vehicle.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go to Portland, it's a wise
investment. The car will run, right? The car will run if it doesn't have it, right?
Actually,
well, yeah,
I don't
of
know.
Course.
I would think so, because it's just lowering the emissions.
Yeah. So I would never know if it was taken off the rental car. I would never know. I just wouldn't know. I just wouldn't look.
You would just
it
get
there.
A bill for $1,500 later in the mail.
Ah!
So.
No.
That's how the rental cars work. I once had this, I had a flat tire in a rental car, and I told them about it when I went back, and they're like, oh, it's no big deal. It's probably just low on air. And like 6 months later, I get a bill for a new tire. And I was like, I told you about this when I had it there. Like, but they definitely hold on to all that information and just wait for it.
Oh, no.
That doesn't make any sense. Like, how many other people drove that car after you in that 6 months? Like, you know, when that
that's
much time goes
what
by,
I
how
said.
Can they even link it to you?
Yep, I don't know.
That's screwy Louie. Yeah.
You know, we found a joint, you know, we found a joint in the seat. 6 months later, we knew it was yours.
No, it was Hunter Biden. It was Hunter Biden.
Yes.
Or the Russians. I don't know. It was Russians or Hunter. I don't know.
Both of them.
Both
they were
of them.
Together.
All right, Lori, and behave.
What, me? I try. This is a really good time. Like, and you know, and there's some subjects that I kind of try to avoid because they're hot items. Like abortion is one of them. I usually try to avoid that topic altogether just because it's such a heated topic on both sides. And it just seems like abortion is one of those things where no side is going to be happy no matter what. You know, finding any kind of common ground solution seems impossible. And so, I mean, I don't want to get into some ugly debate about abortion, but that is a topic that for somebody running for governor, I think, you know, it's reasonable to cover. So what is your position exactly on it? What possible limits might you be agreeable to, or what kind of common ground do you think you could make for both sides to make at least each side a little bit happier? Or, you know, what's your moral stance on it, whatever?
So my personal opinion on abortion is that I'm pro-choice. I think it's a woman's right to choose what she wants to do with her body. I think it's between her and her doctor. I'm a guy, and I also believe that I have no say because I'm a guy. But more than that, I mean, and this is where I think I struggle with the Republican Party in a lot of ways, but to me, it's just freedom. You know, it's just a personal medical decision and freedom. And, you know, we talk a lot about all the freedom for shots or from shots and things like that, but yet we stop at you know, abortion and things. So I think it's up to them to decide. I think that as a society, we can do more, though, to help women have other options. And by that is showing them what options they have available to them, what resources there are. We can make adoption far more affordable. I mean, at $65,000 to adopt a kid these days, I mean, it's crazy. We can do a lot more to help by doing some of those changes so that, that women know there is another option that's out there. And I think any limits on abortion should come from the voters. I don't agree that that is something that should come from a small group of people in the legislature. That is something that should go on the ballot, and it should be decided by voters if they want any kind of restrictions.
Good answer. Good answer. Because, I mean, I think we all have our own personal opinions on it. And, you know, I think that it's one of those things where I know for sure I am against late-term abortions. I am against, you know, when it's a baby, you know, and it just hasn't been born yet kind of a thing. And I just, I find it appalling allowing any kind of late-term abortions. I tend to, like, I got into a debate a while back with a pretty hardcore lefty Democrat, and there's just so, you know, there's so much ignorance involving it. She was literally saying that, you know, since we can pull the plug on people who are brain dead, if they're considered brain dead, you could pull the plug on them. But yet, you know, criticizing how Republicans want to ban abortion because that's life and, you know, life of conception and stuff like that. And she was actually saying that, you know, that a baby is brain dead. They might have a heartbeat, but they're brain dead. And I'm like, no, you know, go and revisit. You know, go and revisit the development of the fetus, and you come to realize that that heart does not start beating on its own. You know, the brain is already being developed. It takes the brain. It takes the initial nervous system to send the signal to the heart to start beating to begin with. So, you know, they're not brain dead. That kind of thing. And it's like, you know, understanding the physiology of it, I think, might change people's minds, but they want to be so, I am pro-choice and blah, blah, blah. They want to be that way so bad, but and yet they don't want to understand fetal development. You know, they don't want to really understand from week to week to week to week, you know, how this miracle is developing inside of a woman's body so quickly. You know, it just in 9 months goes from a cell that's dividing into a person. It's a short, you know, it's amazing to me. And so I think that appreciation shouldn't be forgotten. Like, don't criticize people that are pro-life because they're pro-life, you know, and it's one of those things. But then at the same time, you got to follow that up too. You know, it's you know, if you're going to encourage a woman not to have an abortion, number one comes education that women should understand. You know, like, I'm against laws or, you know, against laws that prevent, like, if a woman's going to get an abortion, then I think it totally makes sense for the woman to make an informed decision and be educated on, okay, you're 13 weeks along, you're 14 weeks along. This is the development of the baby you have inside you right now. This is how far it's progressed. Do you really want to do that? And I think a lot of women that don't really understand fetal development, if they just had that understanding and that education, might just change their mind if they knew exactly where they're at in their pregnancy and exactly that stage the fetus is in. They might very well change their mind.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important to have all that information available to them and for them to be able to make an informed decision.
Yes,
exactly.
And the options, you know, aside from the medical choice of, or whatever you want to call abortion, the procedure, to have the options and a clear pathway to adoption and preventing this from even happening, maybe, you know, making sure in legislation that there remains a semblance of science in schools instead of, you know, them calling it health class and do gender studies instead. Let's talk about how the, you know, sperm and egg hooked up, you know. So, yeah, that I think is lacking in today's society. And it's so many people are focusing on the end result. Well, how did we get here? You know, this is how we got here. So that's, and that as a governor, I think, you know, providing those opportunities and for, you know, more nonprofits to step in and offer pathways to adoption and other choices as well as to make that, to be able to make that informed decision. I believe a person needs to know what all their options are and have a clear path to them. And an advocate, you know, and making that part of social services, not in the essence to police people, but to create that healthy pathway to whether it's parenthood or a healthy adoption or, you know, a difficult medical procedure, you know, whatever it is, to make sure they have that pathway to the information they need. And technology and advances in that will help having that information.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you had a portal,
can look it up.
If you had a portal that had all that information that was readily available, easy to see and easy to understand, you know, and had a pathway, you're right. It's just showing them their options and making sure that they're well informed. But, you know, until adoption is far more affordable, that's a huge option that's taken off the table for almost everybody.
Exactly.
Very few people can afford that. And it's one of the best options that we have available for moms that don't want their kids. They can't handle having a baby, you know, and raising it, you know, but yet we make it unattainable, unaffordable, and for not really any reason. It's just so much in legal fees and then all the hiring the middleman to do it that it just becomes crazy ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's discouraging.
You know, I've often said, I don't know why abortions aren't $50,000 when the adoption isn't $500. But, you know, there you have it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that.
That's
you know, like I said, it's like it's hard for me as a libertarian on the abortion topic because, you know, I am like, it's your choice and whatever. I tend to be pro-choice on just about everything. And yet when it comes to abortion, that's one of those topics where I tend to be more conservative with it. And, you know, for example, you know, I would support like a heartbeat law, for example. Once there's a heartbeat, then no, you don't have the choice about it. Or at the very least, a limit to not have abortions be legal after the first trimester, you know, with some exceptions for health and whatnot, you know, the, you know, life is at risk or something like that. You know, I'd be for those kinds of restrictions because of the fact that I'm also thinking about the right of the child to live. And
That's not something that that's something that voters choose. That's not something a governor would choose.
And I agree.
Yeah,
I think that any change to that has to be by the voters.
Yeah. I mean,
if something comes up from the legislators and the legislature passes it, then it would be fully within your, you know, within the governor's responsibility to veto it or sign it, right? And, you know, as a governor, you could say, no, this legislation needs to go to the voters. I'm not going to accept the legislator voting for it. I'm going to bring it to the people.
And the two parts that I have said publicly that I would never sign a bill for are abortion and guns. Both those have to go to vote by the people. Any restrictions on those two big issues, I think, are too big of issues that should never be decided by a small group of people.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to gun control, I am definitely anti-gun control. And I think that issue is already resolved. We have our Second Amendment. That's it. We already got it.
Yep.
You know?
And I would say any infringement on that you know, obviously there's no, I would not want to sign any of that. So, I mean, it's, and like the, what is it? The SB 554 needs to go away too, because that was an infringement on our gun rights that didn't get voted on by the people.
I refresh my memory. What was that legislation?
That's the lock up your guns legislation, where it has to be locked at your house.
Yeah, I lose track of the numbers, but I remember the actual like legislation and what it is. Yeah, the you know, safe storage, and I am definitely against like mandating insurance. And then there was what was it, 2000? Was it 2000 already, or was it 2021 that Sheila Jackson Lee put in that legislation federal level that wanted to create a database, a public database of all registered gun owners? That floored me right there. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You know, you want a public database, and you want to, number one, register every firearm, everybody that has one, and register all of them. And then number two, you want to make that a public database for anybody to look up. Basically, treat gun owners like sex offenders. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something
no, it's
like
ridiculous.
That, I would seriously hope you would veto.
Yeah, for sure. That's yeah. And I don't. That would never pass with bipartisan support, so I'd veto it anyway.
That's true. I think that we got enough of a balance where, you know, something like that would hopefully not actually pass. Because it still floors me. Oregon is still supposed to be an open carry state. Yet I don't see how we can even be called an open carry state anymore. When
no,
we have
of
the all the regulations
have already
that we do.
Outlawed it.
Yeah. And then not only that, they increased the price for getting your concealed carry permit from $50 to $75, while at the same time further limiting where your concealed carry can even be practiced. You know, so it just doesn't make sense. Why would I want to pay more for a concealed carry and be able to conceal carry in less areas? It doesn't make sense. I think we should do away with the whole concealed carry thing anyway. You know, I think it's dumb. That's an infringement right there. If you have the right to bear arms, you have the right to bear arms, you know, concealed or not. And there shouldn't be an, you know, it's just another way to siphon money out of people and target a specific group of people because they're easy targets in this anti-gun atmosphere that the far left has. And
which is ironic in the state of Oregon, where you have just as many people on the left that own guns as you do on the right. This is like a very pro-gun state. There's not very many that are anti-gun in the state, but yet we still see that erosion of the Second Amendment in Oregon, which is weird.
Yeah, I don't get it. I really don't get it. I mean, some of that stuff has to change, and I think that, you know, let's bring back rifle clubs in schools, you know, gun clubs in schools. Teaching kids to be afraid of guns and teaching kids that guns are bad, don't go near them, all this stuff, I think is the exact opposite of what we need to be doing. You know, we need to bring some of that stuff back. We need to teach kids how to be responsible with guns. Get over the fear, be responsible, and make it something that is normal again. Because that's part of the problem. And, you know, when you see mass shootings happening and stuff, where the vast, vast majority of mass shootings or any shooting usually happens in a gun-free zone or in areas where guns are really restricted. And the two go hand in hand. And so, you know, Dahl always says it best. You say it, Dahl, about gun ownership in Alaska. You always say it best.
What? Oh, I was like, oh, so that gun's my kitchen gun, and that's my car gun, and that one's my kayak gun. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, and you dump Lippy. You don't get lippy with those people. Quite Florida.
Oh, yeah. Well, where I live, there's no public service. We don't have public servant. We have state troopers, but they've got to fly in or come by boat. So they don't come unless somebody really dies or something. And so, and everybody's packing, so nobody ever gets lippy. It's just one of those, it's just, it keeps people civil. Guns keep society civil, is what I say.
Makes
but
sense.
But no, yeah, that's true, though. I have my kitchen gun and I have my kayak gun. So, yeah. We got a little
and
wolf
she does
there,
go hunting.
You know,
right?
Yeah,
she is an avid hunter.
But, yeah.
Yeah, guns are definitely one of those things where, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert at it. I don't go to the shooting range all the time, number one, because I can't really afford it. You know, especially with ammo and stuff. But I have been actually kind of curious about these new laser guns, and you can essentially practice without actually firing any ammo, you know, like with the laser pointer, and it records where you hit, and, you know, your accuracy and stuff. And again, bringing in technology to help with this. You know, if you want to have a gun club in schools and parents are afraid about using live ammo, then technology like this that enables them to practice it, to have, you know, essentially a firearm where they can practice releasing the mag and they can do all this, but no live ammo is involved. They can practice their aim. They can practice their shooting. And it's all technology, you know, and it's
you are breaking up.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Rick. Connect. Yeah. I'm right here. I'm literally a foot and a half away from my Bluetooth connection on my headset, you know, so it's not that. And yet,
it's
here we are.
Now.
Yeah, now
and
you're
here
back.
We are. Yeah.
And I did literally did
moment.
Nothing. I did nothing.
Maybe it's your internet connection.
I doubt it. Usually before my show, I like reboot my router. I reboot my computer. I reboot my phone. I reboot everything. So everything's nice and fresh. So it's usually not. It's but this is what I mean about the direct connect feature being a little bit flaky when it comes to it. And I just think that that's like a bug in the software or something on Blog Talk. But the weird thing is now that I'm on my own account, when I called in using my phone to the host call-in number, I got a message saying that my plan will charge, I can't remember how much per minute. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to, you know, be charged for sitting here for 3 hours, you know, using my phone. So I'm like, okay, I'll use the Direct Connect and flip over real quick. And so I need to figure that out. I don't understand why my plan would charge me for calling in as the host. It's like their way on the cheaper plan to force people to use their buggy Direct Connect. And, you know, and getting a hold of people at Blog Talk sometimes to tell them about the issues, you know, sometimes they're not all that responsive, or, you know, you get your first tier person and then, you know, it's like, no, I, you know, this is a bigger issue. Get me to developer, somebody that knows what they're talking about, you know.
I understand that. That's what my team deals with, although we only have one tier of service, so we don't have any escalations, which is nice, but we do deal with that with third parties all the time.
Kind of cool. You don't have a tiered system?
Yeah, we do everything. All of my guys are like basically what we call tier three, so they can handle any issues on their own. So it's a single call, single result type of setup, which is what I designed from the get-go. I hated tiers, and so I didn't want to have my customers have to deal with that either.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great idea. Because that's kind of what I was used to. You know, I started out at a tier one, and then I ended up tier two, tier three level. support. And, you know, and sometimes it was one of those things where what's frustrating is the tech, you know, the tier one tech that would escalate something. My biggest gripe was they didn't give me all the information. It's like they're so pressured to, like, hurry up. You only have 1 minute to, you know, write up the ticket and then send it on its way before the next call comes in. And so then that leads to poor customer service, because then I get the ticket and all the information isn't there. Like, what did you already troubleshoot? What did you already try? I don't know. Now this customer has to repeat themselves all over again, you know.
Yeah, that's not a good result.
Tried and what they haven't, and they're frustrated, you know. And it's just like, ah. And so I think, you know, a lot of times it's one of the things where, you know, they're trying to, you know, meet that deadline. Their bosses get after them because, oh, they took 2 minutes instead of one in between calls. And that's the focus when it's like, well, maybe that extra minute is time spent so that when I escalate the ticket, that tech knows what we've already tried and has all the details, and maybe that takes an extra minute to type up and let them know. That sort of thing. It's just some of that ridiculousness, I think, the micromanagement of it ends up frustrating both the tech and the customer at the same time, because
absolutely,
they're so micromanaging every single second that one of the tech workers are spending.
You got it. That is so true. That's what I saw, and that's why I didn't do it that way, because customer service is number one. And that's what we need in Oregon, customer service number one.
Yes, exactly. Be treated like a, you know, with respect. And not like, oh, another person with another problem, you know, and the taxpayer is the problem, not me, you know, not the system, not anything else.
Well, that's because they got their union job. They don't got to worry about anything.
Well, they have to be reminded, you know, the constituent is the shareholder. You know, the governor and the elected party are just the temporary CEOs put in care, you know, and not to devalue it. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, of course, as you know, but that needs you as a business person can appreciate that, you know, sometimes you just have to put feelings aside and just take care of business and get things up and running. Then we can talk about your feelings, folks.
Yep. Well, that comes back to,
not to totally interrupt here, but I did just get the 90-second mark a few seconds ago. I'll probably get the 60-second mark here pretty quick, because, you know, the show is scheduled for 2 hours. I'm on the 2-hour plan, but we can definitely still hang out. It'll be part of the recording. So the live broadcast will end here, and then we can definitely continue on for the next hour, and it'll just be part of the show archive and recording for people that go back and listen to it later that might have missed it. So I just wanted to throw that in there. And Dahl Arnson, she's here. She's Alaskan Patriot Network, via Freedomizer Radio on Blog Talk. So take a look for her show on Fridays, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And so I wanted to give that plug real quick before the live broadcast ends. And I definitely thank her for joining here with me today. We got 10 seconds for the live broadcast to end now. And so I just wanted to say that. And I wanted to say on air, thank you, Nick Hess, for coming on as my guest and spending the time with me. And I don't know what your schedule's like or what you know, if you're tired or whatever, but you're more than welcome to continue hanging out.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, like a caller raising their hand, too, so we could take a caller if you're up.
Sure. Happy to.
Right on. Okay. So let's bring on Pionki. I know this caller. He's a regular. So I'm going to bring Pionki on and see what he has to say.
Hello, Lori.
Hello, Pionki. I'm doing pretty great.
Hi,
how are you?
Hello, everybody. No, for the governor candidate, how you doing, sir? issue with abortion, I think that should be left to the states. And, you know, if you read these laws, they're not stopping abortion, but they're setting a limit where you're not having to take a fetus or unborn child, shall I say, and tear it apart in the womb. But, you know, the thing that it does when a woman said, it's my body, well, they also deny a man of his fatherhood. Nobody thinks about that. He is being denied his fatherhood.
Yeah, I think that's a struggle of that whole issue, because you're right. I mean, it is, you are the father. If you are the father, I mean, yes, there are, you know, I think it would be the right thing for the woman to discuss it with you, obviously. But there's that fine line between, you know, personal freedom and what the government's regulating. And honestly, I mean, the best approach that I can see comes back to just education. You know, I think that's the only thing that we can really do from the government standpoint. You know, beyond that, it has to come from the voters. The voters have to decide if they want something different.
Well, you know, another thing, too. What about assisted suicide? Is my life my choice?
I agree. I think it's your choice. I think it's a personal freedom and personal choice.
Yeah. And, you know, I went to your contact page and emailed you, I think, two bills. One was for elections. Of course, you know, the January 6th incident, the Constitution says when there's controversies between one or two states, two or more states, that controversy has to be worked out between those states and pushed along by the people of the state, technically. And that was not being done. And many courts did the right thing. Courts are not supposed to decide election. That issue should have been back to the state. But on a broader sense, and I sent you a bill that I wrote up, I think that federal elections should be separated from state and local elections. Federal ballot, that is. It'd be on the same day. But when you walk into the polling place, you got a special spot for the federal ballot, which is president, vice president, U.S. senator, and congressperson. And that should be, and all, by the way, that's mentioned in Article 1 of the Constitution, too, that Congress has the right to reform that and have it however it wants. It's not taking that issue from the states, but that particular federal ballot. And then they can set
the
vetting.
And your theory is that the federal ballot would be counted separately by the federal government, not by the states?
Yes, by a party of people that's been bonded and vetted, and you have a means of checking. You know, the ballot, when the voter gets done with the ballot, he gives it to the attendee. The attendee gives it to one or three counters. And also, the machines can't be no foreign machines, no foreign software, no hooked up to the Internet or Wi-Fi. Because presently, the way it goes, it's never going to be right because states are not going to fall in line. But the federal government has the ability to do that. And let the states do what they want to. New York, if New York want to let illegals vote, then that's New York's prerogative. But take a look at it when you get it, if you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure. Have you thought about, what are your thoughts on blockchain voting? Have you thought anything about that?
Well, with these ballots, you can have an encrypted address similar to the addresses that follow when you do your transaction with cryptocurrency. So, yes, anything like that along those natures would be fine. But, you know, by the way, since you talk about that, your illustrious president wants to tax unrealized gains, which I think is really ridiculous, because that's going to really open up a lot of complications. If you buy a cryptocurrency, because they have no way right now to trace what you do with those coins. But if you bought a coin,
for the services that you're buying it at now. So, I mean, they do have a way of tracking that because every licensed group that can sell it to you now has to submit their information to the IRS.
Yeah, but that address is yours personally, and you can put that in your pocket.
Right.
They can't trace that. And see, here's the thing. If you bought that corn at $40,000, it goes up to $60,000. Well, immediately, probably, Biden administration wants you to pay that tax on $20,000 immediately. Nothing is said. Now, of course, the details have not been revealed, but I can just imagine this was brought up by the former, I don't know if this lady is still the Secretary of Treasury, but I think this came out of her mindset to tax unrealized gains.
That's just another money grab and trying to make things more equitable in their eyes.
Yes, it is. And it's terrible. But I'm going to let you go. If you get a chance, check those two emails I sent you. I think you may be able to start something.
Yeah, I don't get those emails unless you email it directly to the nick@votehess.com. But if you send it through the website, my team will get it to me in the next couple of days, I'm sure.
That sounds great. It's better than some responses I get out of some Congress people.
Well, if you don't hear from me, then send me another email. But I usually respond to everything. So.
I sure will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Take care, Bianchi.
Thank you, Bianchi. You can stay. You know, you can stay on if you want. I can just.
Okay, I'll mute myself.
Just put yourself on mute, and yeah, you can chime in when you want. I'm not going to kick you off. And same with Nick. I didn't really know how long you were, you know, going to be stick around, Nick. So this is awesome. I was like, okay, you know, I got him for
got
an
like,
hour, but we'll be.
I got like 20 more minutes and I got to go put my kid to bed. So you got me for that long.
Oh, perfect. Okay, good. Good, good, good. And yeah, you know, you got life to deal with too, right? And I hope you had dinner and everything before the show.
Yeah, I'm all good. So I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on crypto voting or on blockchain voting. It's something I've been looking a lot into lately. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are.
I got to admit, I'm kind of a dummy in that regard. You know, and I have, you know, a couple of friends that are more into it than I am, but I just, you know, I'm kind of a dummy when it comes to crypto and everything involved. I will admit that.
So there's really cool tech out there. I was actually approached by the company because they saw that I was a high tech guy. So they gave me like a private tour of the tool and everything. But basically, it's voting just like we have now. But there's a piece that you can peel off your ballot, and it's your crypto key basically. So it's a unique key that you have for that one ballot. So you can actually go up and check the blockchain to see that your vote was counted. When it was counted, and you can see, you know, what it was counted for. So you know that there was no changes at all to your vote. It was exactly everything on the up and up, exactly what you were expecting, and it's your one private key. That's the only way that you can view that information. So it's kind of a cool deal, incredibly secure, but it lets the people be in control of verifying their own vote. So you know, no matter what, as long as enough people are verifying it, that there's no hanky panky happening, which is kind of something that a lot of people talk about in our elections these days.
That's really cool because that's the one thing that, you know, we are lacking. I mean, we're vote by mail, which I do like. However, you can go in and you can check to see that your ballot was received, which is great, but there's no way to verify that who I actually voted for or what measure I actually voted for got recorded correctly.
Correct.
Or like you said, if there's any hanky panky
from the envelope. Yeah. Once they receive it, they take it out of the envelope though, and it goes away from the envelope so that there is no record of who you voted for, which is a privacy thing. But that's the cool part about like the crypto thing and like the blockchain voting is that you could actually see who you voted for, and there's no way anybody else could ever see that. It's completely encrypted. So without the encryption getting broken, which for blockchain type encryption, it's always evolving and incredibly secure. I mean, it's something like 100 million years right now is how long it would take to crack it with current technology. So we're still a long ways away from technology catching up to be able to crack that. But, you know, you would actually be able to go back and check your vote and make sure that it was what it was, which is kind of cool. I think it's very intriguing.
I like it. Well, I like it a lot. I think it's definitely forward moving. And for people that say, I feel like people might hack into my information. Like, but, you know, realistically, if you order a package online, you know, that you're giving up personal information too. So that's kind of moot. And people have their health records on their phone these days. They've mm-hmm. got everything. I think the blockchain is, it's nice because like Lorianne was saying, you know, you can check to see if your ballot was received. But once that envelope is reached, it's off into another system. You know, yeah. And they're not going to fill up. So I think that's really neat. I like that idea that makes it sound a lot more secure with the one-use blockchain code for each ballot or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
I think that's neat, a one and done. You know, can't reuse it. It's like a used-up gift card, no longer valuable, doesn't mean anything.
Yep, and it's never tied to your name, so it's completely private. Yeah, go. Sure. Shoot.
Yeah, and you know, there has to be a way to make sure once a person is vetted, similar to how you would do to receive a U.S. passport, you're going to have
mm-hmm.
voice recognition. When a person show up to vote or to drop off a mail-in ballot, they need to be checked. And that checking system could be either reading the iris in your eyes, facial recognition, voice recognition. There's all sort of technology today that's pretty much foolproof. The ballot has a number which is matching the encrypted number on the envelope to make sure that those things are compliant. Would you guys believe that the primary election that they had in Texas just last week, I believe it was, they already having problems of missing ballots, people showing up at the polling place in trucks, not identifying themselves, taking boxes. You know, what I had in my law is that the count will be done there on site. The ballots go no place. The count is done on site. You got three persons plus a supervisor that verify the count, and they call it in with those three persons monitoring what's being said and agreeing to it on site, not counting 2 weeks later or putting them in vans and taking them someplace where they can be counted off site. No, count them right there where they are cast.
So I take it you don't live in a state that has mail-in voting.
Well, even if you have mail-in voting, when that postal worker or whoever's there at the receipt of these ballots, you know, Pennsylvania, that was one of the things the court said, that the law wasn't being followed because somebody who was a member of the electoral commission was supposed to have been there to receive the ballots where they was being dropped off at. But those can be counted right on site at the end of the day, and that information conveyed on to wherever it has to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to change this to make it better. Yep.
Look at New York. If you got an illegal that can have a ballot, and the way they have it now with the president, congressperson, and U.S. senator on the ballot, how do you know that illegal is not punching or marking off one of those three? You don't. There's no way. Once the ballot is turned in, you don't know who the heck cast it. It might have been me, Laurie. It might have been Jose. We don't know.
That's true.
Bianchi.
You're funny. Yeah, and then
what's
true? Dahl, speak to the ranked choice voting there in Alaska.
Have that in Alaska. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work?
Well, we'll have our first election, and it'll actually be a special election. It'll be Don Young just recently passed, and we have a special primary and special election for that seat, for that at-large Congress seat. Actually, it's not. Yeah, it is the at-large Congress seat. And then we'll have the regular election. So what happens with ranked choice voting is it's actually quite interesting, because I think it's going to give other opportunities for other parties like independent, libertarian, et cetera, to get their names on the actual final ballots. But it's the top four. It's the top four people that were voted for. So the top four vote getters get on that ballot. So now what will happen is I believe it is, yes, yeah, so there'll be four on the primary and two, the top four on the primary go to the final election.
So then is it an open primary?
It's open primary, yeah, for this. Not just for Don Young's seat, for the special election.
Huh, okay.
Okay, so for the regular election with ranked choice voting, the same thing. For the top four go to, all right, so wait. So the top four go to the primary, and then primary, all right, and then the final election, whoever gets the most votes out of the four. So your top four.
Is that like four people per party, or is it it's just four no matter what party you are?
Four, it could be
four.
All Republicans. Yeah, it could be all Republicans. It could be anybody. Yeah, it's really interesting. We've never done it before. This is new for everybody. In fact, we are we have a local group that is going to learn more about it, and then we're going to go out in our community and talk to people. I think one of my biggest worries with ranked choice voting is people are having a hard time grasping it and what it means, and I don't want people to be discouraged from voting because they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's really important. It's a, you know, to understand and feel confident in it. And if it's too much or there's language barriers, that's going to be one less vote. That's going to be one less constituent that exercise that sacred, you know, right that we have as Americans. And that's a shame.
Mm-hmm.
So I make sure I get it right. And I'm going to take this class myself and then go out into the community and help others that don't understand it so that, you know, it's a, I don't care who they're voting for. I want everybody to feel like they're confident at the, I think this is a bad choice, frankly. But looking at it a little more, it gives the underdogs a chance to kind of break free from, you know, behind the pack and kind of shine in their own ways. So, and that's what it's about. It's about getting regular people out there, out of their comfort zone, out of their armchair, and in front of, you know, people that voted for them or want to vote for them. People want choices.
Yeah.
We're sick of the same old names. I'm so sick of it. And I always tell people, for the love of God, please don't vote for somebody because you that's the only name on the ballot you recognize. Yeah, you recognize them because they've been there too damn long.
Yeah. That's the sad reality of our elections, though, is that it always ends up being that name recognition, and you're just like, really? Why?
You
think
again?
For yourself.
You're still alive?
Gosh. That's why we need a convention of the states. It's the only way I see us getting term limits, which we desperately need.
I agree. I really agree with that. You know, if you want to be congressman and be congressman, then you could be work your way up the, you know, or be senator. I have no problem with that. But just to stay in Congress or Senate for decades and decades, just it's unacceptable.
Well, you're so disconnected from the constituents that put you there. I mean, there's no way, but you don't have to even campaign to win at that point. You're just automatically winning. So you have no reason to be anything to your constituents. I mean, there's no reason to listen to them at all. What are they going to do?
Yep.
Nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
They're not going to vote you out.
Look at Nancy Pelosi's constituents. You know, she things like
know.
That. For love of God,
her
they all live in Skid Row.
Boggles my mind. She gets anybody to vote for her.
Yeah, and all of us will look at it from the outside and go, "Who's voting for this person?"
Yeah, or AOC. I look at that and I'm like, "Holy crap! What's wrong with those folks in New York?"
Yeah, in the last election, I was like, I'm not voting to reelect anybody. You know, like if you've already been sitting there for 4 years and you haven't solved any of these problems, then I'm not gonna reelect you. You know, time for new blood. And I'm definitely for term limits too, because I mean, originally in our founding, being a congressperson or being for the legislature, a part of any office for that matter, was never meant to be a career. It was meant to be serving your country. You know, you already had a career. You already had a life outside of politics. It was never meant to be set up so that people can be elected to Congress when they're 30 years old and then continue to be elected until the day they're put in a coffin or they decide to finally retire.
That's another thing I don't understand. Who wants to do this for their whole life until they die? I don't get it. I want to retire and enjoy my retirement. I don't understand these people.
Well, they get paid too much. They get paid too much and the benefits are too great. Their pay should be maybe something a little bit over what it was being paid coming out of civilian life. And if they was unemployed, we'll put some kind of multiplication factor on unemployed benefits. But to be paid a pension after serving, what, one term? Is that how they'd go? That is totally ridiculous.
Yep.
And then they got free medical and all these other perks along with the turn your head items that they receive also. It's totally ridiculous. And you're right. You look at Nancy Pelosi's constituents, they don't even have shoes to walk in to get to the polls, let alone to make a good judgment once they get there.
Yep. Not to mention, how does somebody who makes $220,000 a year end up worth, like, what, $150 million?
Yeah, that's
kinda
why I support, like, not using insider knowledge to make yourself a multimillionaire in a short amount of time. You know, it's like the concepts of conflicts of interest just seem to not even exist anymore. The concept of ethics seems to not exist anymore in government.
Yep. I agree. We see it all the time.
Exactly. And then, you know, open disclosure of donors, of course. I want to know. I want to know if you're taking thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars from Pfizer so that you will take over that office and do their bidding, you know, that kind of thing. There's just way too much of that, way too much underhanded dealings behind the scenes that goes on. And, you know, how is anything ever going to change if these levels of corruption are accepted as like, oh, it's just the way it is. Accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't change it. That shouldn't be the way it is at all.
Yep, I agree. That's why we need the Convention of the States. That's our best chance.
Yep.
And that is something I would advocate for us to join on with. And you know, as the governor, I would really push the legislature to take up the Convention of the States Act so that we could be a part of that process.
Yes, and I think, you know, if we have somebody that's level-headed as our state governor, then maybe there won't be such a push for breaking up Oregon into that, like, greater Idaho, you know, taking, you know, eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, and making it all like one big Idaho, like the Texas of the Northwest, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe there wouldn't be such a push for that if there's somebody sane that's actually, you know, and not just governor, but, you know, all the way down the line, you know, from from your sheriff, from your community leaders, to your local representatives and legislature, all the way on up to governor, start electing some actual sane, real people, and people that actually listen to their constituents. You know, that's just the way it should be.
I think if we can show something different at the top, it'll make things change all the way down. You'll see people looking for that same type of person, that same type of change. Somebody who actually wants to do the work and is not doing it as a retirement gig, which is a lot of our legislature, to be fair, just like the federal, the state has the same problem. People do it as a retirement gig. They don't do it because they got the energy and the fight to make change. They do it because, well, it was easy to get the job and they get paid while they're retired. So that all needs to change. But I think starting with having somebody, you know, young with a little bit of fire at the top can change some of that all the way down through the system.
Very true. And then, of course, when you're all the way at the top, when you're working with local communities and local leaders, county leaders, things like that, you get inspired by them as well. When you're out of touch with so much, then there's no relating to each other. And that's where Kate Brown is faulty, because she's not relating to anybody that doesn't side with her. You know, it's just anybody that disagrees with her, she doesn't want to take seriously. She doesn't want to be open-minded enough to go, maybe they have a good point. And so I think even from the lower level, you know, people that are in their, you know, community leaders, they can really inspire the top as well. It can be a two-way street.
I agree. That's very true. But you got to be willing to listen to them.
Yep, exactly. And I do know that it's about time you get your kids to bed. Ready by time.
Yep.
And time to relax and stuff. So before we let you go, I don't want to kick you off, but I do want to respect your time. So before you go, definitely let listeners know where to find you, where to look you up, all that good stuff. Plug yourself.
Okay. Awesome. Well, you can find out more about me on votehess.com. I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, all of the social stuff at VotePest22. And so you can find me on all of those. I do videos every week with different ideas that I have, and you know, they're usually pretty short. They're like a minute. And we're rolling out a new series of like 30-second or less things on the road, since I'm on the road so much going into this election. But, you know, I think that Oregon has a good opportunity for some change this time around, and I really hope that you find some things in me that you like and want to learn a little bit more about me and see how I can really help the state thrive. So, you know, I'm also very accessible, so you can reach out and email me or whatnot, nick@votehess.com. It's also online as well. So thank you very much for having me, Lori. I appreciate it.
Perfect.
Thank you, Nick.
And it was good to meet you too, doll.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I really appreciate your time tonight. You definitely stayed longer than I expected, and so I really appreciate it. Your time is valuable, and I hope that you found the show to be valuable and good conversation, because I know I have. We touched on a lot of subjects and covered a lot of ground in a relatively short amount of time. So I, again, really appreciate
it,
and good luck.
Thank you very much. You guys take care.
You too. Have a great night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All righty, so there we have it. That was Nick Hess running for Oregon governor on the GOP ticket, one of several candidates that have put their hat in this race. And so, Dahl, I think you're also needing to cut things short tonight. Do you have to skedaddle as well?
Yeah, I was going to stay a few more minutes. I told the boys that they wouldn't die of starvation yet. I didn't know we were doing a 3-hour. I was like, oh, she's on a 2-hour again, you know. So I told them, you can wait until after the show. So, yeah. That was a great interview.
They're not going to dry up and blow away in the wind if they wait an extra, you know, few minutes or hour or something.
No, in fact, I hear them starting the prep on it, so that'll be good. I just do the final magic.
Very good.
Oh,
yeah,
my
this,
goodness.
Yeah, we didn't take a break either. I hate interrupting good conversations by taking a break, and yet we only have a half hour left of the show recording time because, again, the live broadcast ended after 2 hours, and so this last hour is part of the recording versus live.
Nice.
That will change. That will change. I am just waiting for Blog Talk to have one of their occasional specials for, you know, 25% off, or even around Christmas time, I've seen they have up to 50% off to upgrade to another one of their plans. So I'm just keeping an eye out. I definitely don't want to have to wait till Christmas for that. But every so often they'll do like a 25 or a 30 or something. And so if I can take advantage of saving some money, then I'm going to hold off upgrading until I can save some money on that upgrade, you know, going from the $40 plan to the $100. And then if that $100 is, you know, knocked off a bit, then that makes it more affordable. And then I can be back to the usual 3-hour live broadcast.
Yep. Hey, so, all right, you know how we're always like, there's no justice in these kids, you know, speaking of Portland tonight reminded me of this article I had ran across. And this was in Nashville. And this 26-year-old young man was charged or was sentenced Wednesday by U.S. District Judge Alita A. Trauger to 5 years in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release for torching a courthouse during the Summer of Love, you know, the death of George Floyd. It says here, and I've seen very, very, very little aside from the sensational cases like Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, or anything on the follow-up. And I'm sure there's local judges and stuff that are taking care of this case by case, you know. But overall, these people pretty much got away with murder, rape, mayhem, looting, burning cities down. And to see somebody actually, you know, getting in trouble for it, it's kind of refreshing, I have to say.
Yeah, it's nice to see some of this, you know, even though it's a small fraction getting prosecuted, it's nice to see that something's actually getting prosecuted, right?
Faced 20 years in prison. But
good.
He got off
gets every
pretty
single
light,
one of
you
them,
know.
And not some lenient judge that'll just be like, "Oh,
no,
give
they
me
sentenced
a
him." Well, they sentenced him to 3 years jail and then 5 years of supervised release. You know, but it's just nice for being able to see that kind of catching up with some of those folks. And you know, especially after January 6th and the trumped up charges that these folks and the just injustice. They've been denied their fair due process and speedy trials, and they have not been heard by a jury of their peers and a lot of times, and it's sad.
Yeah, it is really sad. And yet, you know, on the opposite perspective, it's like, okay, but, you know, you can go and burn down a federal courthouse or attempt to throw Molotov cocktails at it and attack it and all that stuff and get treated better in the legal system than the people that just were there and didn't hurt anybody in January 6th. It's just the hypocrisy of it all is aggravating.
Yeah, and, you know, I thought that this was kind of wearing off, this, you know, because we're seeing this about face, with the looming elections and whatnot, with the crime and whatnot, and these mayors and people going, oh, we need funding for the police, you know, and stuff. But then we've got, you know, Kenji Brown Jackson, who is, you know, being confirmation hearings become, you know, lifetime justice, and she can't even define what a woman is. And they,
our favorite J.T. Sears just did a new one about fine what a woman is, the Biden SC pick. He just put one out earlier today, and I wanted to try to get to
today?
As well, now that you're speaking on that topic. Yeah, he just put one out today.
Yeah. Well, before we get to it, though, instead of being like, holy shit, this woman cannot define what a biological woman is. You know, instead of doing that, people are trolling on the senator that asked that very simple question, Marsha Blackburn. I mean, the people are completely trolling on that. And it's like she asked a question that didn't waste time whenever the answer was provided. And the answers, and this is somebody that we want as a lifetime justice, not going to go away unless they die, justice,
yeah.
that cannot
or unless they,
define what a
you
woman
know,
is.
Retire.
Yeah, unless they retire. Well, then, but most
that
of them
doesn't
don't.
Really happen,
just dying. Yeah. And it's so infuriating. And we are talking about, you know, sentencing and the, just, you know, she's known to be soft on sex predators, and in her judgments, in her written judgments, she said that she didn't want to ruin the lifetime of one person because they looked at, you know, pictures of pornography, child pornography online. What about the children that were abused making that pornography? What about that
exactly.
1 second of that pervert's enjoyment was a lifetime of terror for that child in that moment? What about that? That is somebody that's going to be making some really, really tough decisions if they are, you know, be asked to rule on some very tough things. And I just don't have the confidence that she's qualified for it.
Exactly. I mean, if you want to take a stand against human and child trafficking and sex trafficking, and having a Supreme Court justice like her is going in the opposite direction. Vote people in like that or bring people in like that and. You know, there goes it. Here comes more, just like, you know, like floodgates, you know, opening up the southern border. You know, you're going to have even more encouragement, put it that way, of these child sex traffickers.
And
do it even more because they know that they're not going to, you know, they're going to be shown lenience.
Yeah, you can't say she's not qualified, but you can say she's incompetent. And, she lacks another skill. I can't think of the word for it, but I mean, people need to go after her. And there was another time back in 2005, 2003 when they were nominating another black judge. Her name was Janice Rogers Brown, but she was too highly conservative. And Joe Biden went after her. And made statements that he did too. That I mean, it was totally ridiculous. But that's what we have
and
to
then
deal
Biden,
with.
Well, mm-hmm. Biden twice when this gal, this Jackson gal, was running for to be a district judge or something in D.C. and twice.
Mm-hmm.
He said that she, twice he turned down her nomination.
Yeah, that was the one I was talking. My name is Janice.
Oh.
I think she's retired.
Oh, Janice.
Now.
Oh, I thought it was the same one. Okay, I thought that was awfully ironic. Okay, no. Okay, then that's the one. Yeah, twice he went after that gal that you're talking about then. Yeah. But, yeah,
those Democrats are treacherous. Very, very treacherous. Especially, Joe say I sound like Al Sharpton, but especially the black ones, they are treacherous as worse as anybody else when it comes down to that. But anyway, each his own.
Yeah.
Very true.
Exactly. No,
the latest J.P. Sears, it was actually from yesterday, not today. But I thought it was today. But my days blended it together. Since we're on that subject, I figured I would kick this off here. It's about almost 13-minute long clip, so we should be able to sneak that in and then have a little bit of time left to comment afterwards. So, Dahl, Pianki, you up for sticking around for 13 minutes until this clip ends? And because you know we love J.P. Sears.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Perfect. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1, launch.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
Can I provide a definition?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
I can't.
Wow. We'll explain that in a second, along with some shockingly unnerving facts about this judge. But first, welcome to tonight's special report on Biden's race and gender-based pick for the Supreme Court. The judge that the deep state has instructed Biden to nominate for the Supreme Court is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. What Biden likes about her is that she's black, which is cool, because Biden doesn't seem to like that about most black people. As we reported previously, Biden championed the crime bill, which needlessly put many black men in prison, but more importantly, he called KKK recruiter Robert Byrd a friend and mentor while giving the eulogy at his funeral. Mentoring Biden to judge people based on the color of their skin, as the KKK does? Well, Joe was a pretty good apprentice, apparently. Which means what Biden stands for is the opposite of what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stood for, which adds up perfectly. After all, instead of picking people based on their ability, picking a woman based on the color of her skin has worked out very well for Biden previously. Picking Kamala Harris as vice president based on those same criteria has worked out just as successfully as wearing a meat suit to repel tigers works. One of the most impressive achievements of Judge Jackson was revealed when she shared that she has the inability to define what a woman is. Let's take a look.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
Can I provide a definition?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
I can't.
You can't?
Not in this context.
So
I'm not a biologist.
You need a biologist to define what a woman is? But I thought your team says gender is a social construct, not a biological one. So are you sure you can define what a woman is?
I'm not a biologist.
Well, Judge, neither is Biden, but he's nominating you because you're a woman, and you don't even know what a woman is. Therefore, you're not even sure if you're a woman. So how does Biden know you're a woman? These are the questions we want to censor. And the critics might say, well, she's really that dumb that she doesn't know what a woman is, then she has no business being on the Supreme Court. But if she is smart enough to know what a woman is, and is just lying and pretending she doesn't know in order to fit the Marxist agenda of the people trying to place her in the Supreme Court, then she has no business being in the Supreme Court. The critics might say that no matter how you add it up, she's a terrible pick that'll be serving the best interest of shady people rather than the American people. But the critics aren't mathematicians. So apparently they can't add things up to this obvious conclusion. Let's move along. Before we take a look at unnerving facts about Judge Jackson, let's see how well received she was by what's called sane people on the internet. Deborah Lee says, if you can't define a woman, why on earth should you be able to define our law? Well, Deborah, I think destroying the law and the Constitution is the intention here. So on that basis, what a dumb racist question you ask. And Chad Prather says, Can someone tell me how a Supreme Court justice that can't define what a woman is supposed to interpret the 19th Amendment? The 19th Amendment guarantees women the right to vote. So Chad, with judge diversity at the bench, most women will lose their right to vote. Why? Well, as the new part-time Supreme Court justice and full-time communist can't tell what a woman is. Therefore, she won't know who to guarantee the right to vote to. Pop quiz! Which one is a woman? I don't know. I'm not a biologist. Could it be the one with the word woman under it? I don't know. I'm not a reader. Is it warm outside today? I don't know. I'm not a meteorologist. Are you planning on doing the bidding of nefarious people once you're in the Supreme Court? I don't know. I'm not an honest person. It seems that most people don't support Biden's pick nearly as much as the deep state that picked Biden's pick supports Biden's pick. More on that in a minute. But first, let's get unnerved. Judge Jackson sympathizes with pedophiles and wants to bring leniency about violating children to the highest court in the land. The radical left has a movement to normalize pedophilia, and Judge Jackson is doing her best to toe that same satanic silky line. Why does the left want to reduce the stigma about the worst crimes against innocent children that you can think of? Well, we'll leave that to your imagination and Satan. Let's take a look at Judge Jackson defending pedophiles who just want to use the internet to violate children.
On the internet, with one click, you can receive, you can distribute tens of thousands. You can be doing this for 15 minutes, and all of a sudden, you are looking at 30, 40, 50 years in prison.
That, for some reason, doesn't sit well with people who serve God rather than a communist agenda. Let's take a look at Senator Lindsey Graham speaking up for the small minority of everyone in the face of her pro-pedophilia position.
All of a sudden, you are looking at 30, 40, 50 years in prison.
Good. Good.
I understand.
Absolutely good. I hope you are.
To do.
Good.
Allow her to finish, please.
I hope you go to jail for 50 years. If you're on the internet trolling for images of children in sexual exploitation. So you don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a horrible thing.
I wonder why Biden wants people who don't think pedophilia is a heinous, disgusting crime. Still can't figure it out. But there's more. It's just being hidden. Judge Jackson handed out overly light penalties in child pornography cases she's ruled over. But Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin, that's a funny name, shockingly a Democrat, refused to make those pre-sentencing reports public, preventing the GOP from seeing them. But at least Judge Jackson isn't backed by some of the most destructive evil people on the planet. Now let me read this next part, which will hopefully prove that to be true. Judge Jackson is backed by a Democratic dark money nonprofit called Demand Justice. Demand Justice hides who their donors are. That's your first clue. Typically, when people have everything to hide, you have nothing to worry about. Demand Justice is led by former Hillary Clinton campaign staffer Brian Fallon. The plot thickens. Where there's Hillary Clinton, there's usually George Soros not too far away. But with pedophilia and Marxism, he probably wouldn't be involved here. Oh yes! Yes, he is! George Soros provided $2.6 million of funding to Demand Justice. So the Supreme Court pick that the deep state is having Biden pick is backed by Soros. Does that make Soros part of the deep state? I don't know. Let's move on before I get shot. But no, it's Biden's pick. This has nothing to do with Soros. Of course. But here's a fun fact for you. A person named Paige Herwig serves as senior counsel and special assistant to Biden and is his point person on judicial nominations. Herwig was previously Demand Justice's senior counsel. That is a lot of George Soros influence on the President of the United States. But there's a few degrees of separation, so we can pretend like there's not.
Okay, George. Jeez,
I'll keep my mouth shut. Why can't you just threaten to kill my family like an adult? On the heartwarming side of things, Judge Jackson has helped empower abortion. But, specifically, it's at least late-term partial birth abortions. So now at least we don't have to get into the debate of, are they babies or not? Because they're definitely babies she's empowered to have killed. And as an attorney, she's also worked to kill the First Amendment. Or shall we say, abort the First Amendment to sound more progressive. Down with babies, right? And in other news about the good judge, when it comes to judging people not based on the content of their character, but rather the color of their skin, Judge Jackson seems to be all about critical race theory while pretending she's not when she's confronted about it. She sits on the board of a school that recommends a plethora of books teaching critical race theory to the young children that attend this school. Here's Senator Cruz questioning her about specific content in one of her school's recommended books.
They recommend the babies confess when being racist. Now, this is a book that is taught at Georgetown Day School to students in pre-K through second grade, so 4 through 7 years old. Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that, that babies are racist?
Senator.
You know, the problem with babies being racist would be solved if we could just kill all babies before they're born. Then we'd have no more infantile racism. But you better be careful, because if you kill all the babies, then there won't be any kids for your pedophiles to commit heinous crimes against. Right, Judge Jackson? That's it for our special report on Biden's Supreme Diversity pick. You're in good hands as Biden is appointing the most qualified skin colors to govern against our Constitution. Now, it dawns on me, because I'm not a biologist, I have no clue if my wife's a woman or not. So I'm going to go see if I can hire a biologist to study my wife's crotch so we can get some answers here. We'll see. Goodbye! This just in! Because the possibility of being deplatformed threatens your and I's ability to connect, I would love to have you join my email list to ensure we stay connected. You can do that by going to awakenwithjp.com/join me. See you there. Thank you for watching this video, and I want to thank the sponsor of the video, Blue Blocks, which makes my favorite evidence-based blue light blocking glasses, and they also make my favorite red light therapy devices. Red light therapy has earned its place in the cutting edge of the biohacking world. Here's why I love it. It's an easy and effortless way to help accelerate the recovery from injuries, which is something I do to myself a little too often. It helps with recovery from exercise. It has anti-aging effects on your skin. And amongst other benefits, it also stimulates the mitochondria of your cells to produce ATP, which means it gives you more energy. As part of my health and vitality routine, I love to do 20-minute red light therapy sessions. And here's the cool part. Blue Blocks has a variety of red light therapy devices to fit all your needs. There's the larger unit, the Hive Max, to completely immerse you in red light. There's the Hive Mini for spot treatments. And now there's the new Hive Bullet, which is the most portable, travel-friendly red light therapy device I've ever seen. I really want my elbow to heal. I don't actually have an elbow injury, but I'm going to fake one because I like to get attention from being injured. If you want to boost your wellness program with red light, then Blue Blocks has the device for you. To check them out, just go to blueblocks.com/JP. And because you are a viewer of mine, be sure to use a discount code JP, which will get you 15% off. Enjoy.
All righty, everybody, we are back. We got about 5 minutes left. Yeah, Doll's still here. Pianki's still on the line, I see. So that's all a good thing. Gotta love JP Sears. How do I know if my wife is a woman? I'm going to hire a biologist to study my wife's crotch.
That's okay.
Oh,
well, it's
goodness.
A shame that they're feeding those materials to the kids. That one book.
Oh, yeah.
The title was Anti-Racist Baby. It's just terrible.
Yeah, no, it's unacceptable. You know what you do if your kid's a little shit? You spank them. That's how you fix them. You know, but they're not inherently born one way or another. They're learning this. Yeah, this is baloney. Baloney.
Exactly.
And people are just eating it up, and they're allowing all this ridiculous division to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's not existent. I mean, you ask people, you know, I mean, I don't even have to ask my friends. If I thought that they were like that, then I wouldn't want to be around them. But they're, you know, a mixed mash of all kinds of people. So, and I see that all around me. So this racism stuff is, I'm not saying there's not bad people in this world, but they come in all shapes and colors. You know, they're not all just white people aren't all bad.
No, evil has no distinction for skin color.
Yeah.
That is very true. And we are here in our last couple of minutes. So, Doll,
yeah.
I want you to be able to plug your show before we sign off for the evening.
Right. Cool beans. All right, everybody, tune in. You can catch Lori Ann there, too, Alaska Patriot Network, Fridays, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific and 2 to 5 p.m. if you're in Alaska. We've always got great guests, topics, current events. I do regional as well as, you know, worldwide events. Kind of a continuation, except for with a little Alaskan flair, with a twist of West Coast with Lori Ann. So, yeah, everybody, we have Bob Lyons this next week. Yes, I know we had him recently, but with Don Young's passing, all of our people running for that seat are on a accelerated schedule now if they're doing special election. So he'll be joining us again. Lori Ann will be there, and that's about it. And you can find me at Blog Talk, easy peasy.
Yep, Freedomizer Radio. So her show is under Freedomizer Radio, like mine used to be. And, yeah, this is the first night of running my own show here. My own
account. Got your own place, baby. Nice place
you got. I got my own place. It's going to be a work in progress.
It's always great. It's always great to hear your voice.
Thank you very much. You guys have a safe evening and catch you next time.
Yes,
absolutely.
Sir. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in, Pianki. I'm so glad to get that I saw you call in, and thank you for your support, and I thank everybody that listens for their support. And you can find me now, Lucid Libertarian, on blogtalkradio.com. You can also find me on Facebook, of course. Follow Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann on Facebook. Definitely like, follow, share, because, of course, Facebook is censoring me, so you have to actually go there. You're probably not going to see a whole lot of my stuff in your feed because I'm in a forever 90-day restriction with Facebook. But so definitely continue listening. Next week, actually, I do not have a guest, but I do have Alan McFarlane, who is the Laughing Libertarian. He was a previous guest on the show. I'm going to try him out, a possible new co-host, and I think it would be kind of fun with him. He has a great sense of humor, got along with him pretty well when he was on the show as my guest. And so next week I'm going to try him out as a co-host and see how it goes with him. Yeah, and then April 10th, 6 from now, looks like my episode has ended, so this probably won't even be part of the recording, but I have Richard Gates coming on, AIA, definitely 9/11 Truth, former founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He's coming back on the show with his wife, Gail, who is his partner now as much as his wife in business as well as life. So it's going to be a great show on April 10th as well. So, yeah, we'll keep going. And then I have the Cajun Libertarian, Noel, gosh, what's his last name? Oh, I'm so dumb. Cajun Libertarian coming on the 17th of April. So I got him lined up, Noel Olindi, the Cajun Libertarian. And so that could possibly be a pretty neat show because we'll have Lucid Libertarian with guest Cajun Libertarian with possibly co-host Laughing Libertarian. So we got a trilogy going on.
Yes, you do. I'm being replaced.
You're still welcome to call in, of course. I don't mind having two co-hosts. And you and I get along so well, too. But, you know, I don't, you know, so I wanted to try them out, you know, see how it goes.
Definitely.
And maybe this show will be, you know, me and two co-hosts. And the two co-hosts back each other up, you know. Doesn't hurt to have a backup, right?
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so we should probably get going here. The recording is already.
Yeah, I should feed my boys.
Yeah, they're hungry. And thank you so much for joining me again. And
my pleasure.
I'm glad that we're going to continue together as a team.
Yes.
I invite you to my place. You invite me to your place.
It's just a party. All right. I do. I have to get off here. Thanks, sweetheart. Loves you a lot.
Yep, thank you.
Good night.
Yep. Good night to you,
all right,
too. Bye-bye. Love you, too, hon. Bye.